Meeting of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District to order. Madam Clerk, do we have a quorum?
We have a quorum with all board members present.
All right. Who has the board goals today? Ms. Scott?
Vision. Matsu Borough School District will be a model of excellence in teaching, learning, and engaging all students. Mission. Matsu Borough School District prepares students for success. Beliefs. We believe that all students can and want to learn. Success breeds success. The needs and best interests of students drive all decisions. Stakeholders' participation is crucial to student success. Core values. Stewardship, accountability, empathy, quality, integrity, efficiency, respect, collaboration, commitment. Goals. We will improve student success, achievement, and performance by focusing on their career and college readiness. We will increase the graduation rate. Our schools will welcome families and community members in the education of our youth. We will create and maintain a safe and healthy environment for our students and staff. Annual objectives accountability, assessed by quarterly metrics and timelines.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Mr. Keough to lead this in the flag salute and pledge of allegiance.
I move to approve the agenda.
Second.
I would like to amend the agenda as written to move item B, the Denina Elementary School 35% design presentation from the administrative reports down to the non-action items to be included with item A of the non-action items. Is there any objection?
Is there any objection?
I have to have a second, too.
Can we have a second on that?
I'll second that.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. No objection noted, so we have our agenda approved. We're moving to persons to be heard on non-agenda items. Madam Clerk, can you read the rules for us?
Specifically under the agenda item, persons to be heard, the following guidelines apply. The speaker states his or her name for the record. The speaker is limited to 3 minutes per meeting. The speaker is limited to non-agenda items. Agenda items will be open for public comment as they appear on the agenda. The speaker's comments should be appropriate for all audiences, including school-aged children. The speaker is limited to comments of a general nature, positive or negative, which may not be attributed to any specific individual. Issues involving concerns specific to any single individual should be submitted in writing and given to the board clerk to be resolved. The issue may be determined to be appropriate for persons to be heard or may be handled in executive session or may be routed through a more appropriate complaint process. No disturbance or willful interruption of any board meeting shall be permitted. Persistence by an individual or group shall be grounds for the chair to terminate the privilege of addressing the meeting. The board may remove disruptive individuals and order the room cleared if necessary. This is not a question and answer time. Speakers may be referred to the superintendent or designee or take the issue under advisement. And there's a maximum of 1 hour per meeting, and this is the first half hour. Angela Phillips. Come forward. State your name for the record, please.
Work at Thielen Elementary. I have a question before I speak on this. It says that non-board related, that I can't speak on something that you're going to be voting on later. And I see that you have a resolution about SB 90, and that's what I wanted to speak about. Can I still say something?
We will be getting to that right at the very end of our meeting, I believe. So if you want to speak on that item, it's right toward the end of the meeting.
So I need to sit down.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Next on the list is Warren Keel.
President Pauger, members of the Assembly, Superintendent Stone, I'm here as a long time resident of Chicoloon and want to speak to you about a recommendation to improve bus transportation to our community. And I think it may the issue was raised recently in the Joint Assembly School Board meeting. Chicoloon has no public school. It's about equidistant from the nearest middle school and high schools, which would be Glacier View on the eastern end of the Glen Highway and the Palmer Middle and High Schools on this end. It's about 25-plus miles either way from the Chicoloon River Road. A week ago, our community council voted an unusual unanimous vote, 24-0, to make a couple of recommendations to the school board to improve transportation. There is a gap between the end of the Palmer High School and Middle School bus route, which ends at about mile 76 at the Glen Highway in Chicoloon near the post office, and then the bus that goes to Glacier View is several miles further up the highway. Sometimes the terminus is Victory Road. Other times it's, I think, about approximate mile 83 or so. Anyway, so there's this five-mile gap in between. The boundary between the Glacier View School and the Palmer Schools is a line that was kind of arbitrarily drawn some years ago just to the west of the Chicoloon River Road, which is right at the Chicoloon River. It extends northerly about a mile and a half. It's a paved road. It's a state-maintained road, and it has a large bus turnaround at the very end of it. So the issue is there are about five students or so and three families that reside, some within the Palmer District, some within the Glacier View District. And I have 47 seconds left. How did that happen? But the point is the community council requests that the bus transportation to Palmer be extended to the end of the bus turnaround, which would extend the route about, I believe, about 3.5 miles. And we recommend, the community council rather recommends, that this happen by either one of two ways: either make an exception to the existing transportation policy, since the end of the road is just a couple hundred feet outside the boundary, or preferably change the dividing line, the boundary between Glacier View School and the Palmer Schools, and align it along the existing Chicoloon River Road. Such a change wouldn't impact student enrollment at Glacier View School, and I know that's an issue with us. There's been diminishing enrollment at Glacier View for some time, as there is at Sutton Elementary School, but this in no way would affect enrollment there. None of the kids nearby attend Glacier View School, and there's none in the horizon that will be attending. So basically, the community council requests that you direct the administration to make such a change or make an exemption to existing policy. The parents had requested the first one in August and a later one in October that this change occur, and those were denied. So the community council has decided to weigh in. So anyway, and I'd be happy to answer any questions with a phone call or sometime in the future about the issue. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
There are no other people signed up on the list.
Is there anyone in the audience tonight who would like to make comment to the school board at this time? All right. Seeing no one, we will move on to administrative reports. Assistant Superintendent Mr. Stone.
Thank you, President Pauger. Tonight we're going to start off with Dr. David Tarsi and Mr. Tarsi has worked with our district before, and he is back for another round of post-secondary studies, and he's going to share about 10 minutes of slides with you and then give you an opportunity for some question and answer.
Madam President and the school board, thank you for having me here tonight. It's a pleasure to be back. I was here 2 years ago to talk about the first study. This is a continuation and a follow-up with some revisions. I'll try to get through these slides relatively quickly. The packet you have has more slides than what you, what everyone will see here. If you have questions, I'd ask that you wait to the end, and I understand that this will be a lot of information in a very short amount of time. So if you have questions at a later date, please don't hesitate to either contact me or provide those questions to Mr. Stone, and I will gladly answer them. The purpose of the study was to look at graduates who are 1, 3, and 7 years out to determine post-school outcomes for employment and post-secondary education. We explored perceptions of school curricula and satisfaction with high school, post-high school experiences as well. In terms of data reliability, for 1 year graduates, we had a 35% response rate, a 35% response rate for the 3 year graduates, and a 32% response rate for the 2006 graduates, who were much more difficult to contact. In terms of representativeness of respondents, we looked at a number of different demographic categories. For instance, gender. For 2010 graduates, there were 1,136 graduates, 512 of them were male, 624 were female. And you can see the frequency of respondents in the second column at 54% and 45%. And we subtract the respondent percentage from the population percentage. And you can see our response rate differential is 0.1%. for males and minus 0.1% for females, meaning that it's almost identical. So we did that with all of the schools for each of the years. And this is just another example for response rate differential. And what we're really looking for here is for schools and demographics to be within a plus or minus 3% response rate to get a sense of how close our respondents mirror the actual population. In terms of data reliability, I think the study was really good. The only demographic categories that fell outside of plus or minus 3% were 2006 Palmer students and 2012 Palmer students being slightly overrepresented, along with Colony students in 2012 being slightly overrepresented, and Rochelle students being underrepresented by minus 4.1 and 3.2% in 2006 and 2012. Studies. I would not think that this would bias our results in any way. If it got up to 7, 8, 10% or more, I would then add a caveat to say that maybe our results are skewed slightly. But this looks fairly good. In terms of education definitions, higher education, we looked for 2012 graduates, whether or not they claim to be enrolled in a 2 or 4 year college or university. For 2006 and 2012 graduates, we asked the same question, except we asked follow-up questions concerning completion or continued enrollment or discontinuation. The other categories for education were vocational technical training and then short-term employment training. Employment characteristics, we looked at level of employment, full-time, part-time more than 20 hours a week, and part-time less than 20 hours a week. We also looked at the presence or absence of benefits, and the types of work, employers, and types of economic activity. In terms of employment, for one-year graduates, 41% were employed full-time, 21% were employed part-time more than 20 hours a week, part-time less than 20 hours a week, 5%, 28% were not working, and 6% did not answer the question. Out of those who were employed, 17% who were full-time were also enrolled in higher education. 11% more than 20 hours a week were enrolled in higher ed. 2% enrolled in higher ed who were part-time less than 20 hours a week. And out of those not working, 22% were enrolled in higher education. will get to unemployment and not working shortly. For 2010 graduates, this is 3 years out, 47% were employed full-time, 18% part-time more than 20 hours a week, 4% less than 20 hours a week, 30% were not working. We have similar numbers who were enrolled in education, higher education, as part of the reason or overlap for not working and the other things that they were doing. For seven-year graduates, full-time employment was at 63%, part-time more than 20 hours a week, 10%, part-time less than 20 hours a week, 2%, and not working at 23%. A smaller percentage were continued to be enrolled in higher education. As you can see, a comparison across those three charts, full-time grows over time. More people start working full-time. Part-time, less than 20 hours a week, or more than 20 hours a week declines, as well as part-time, less than 20 hours a week declines. The not working component stayed roughly the same. Reasons for not working. In school, 35% in 2012, 38% 2010, 17% 2006 because they've been in school long enough to graduate or not continue school. Those who said they couldn't find a job in 2006, these are people who are not working, 11%, and that's out of the entire population of respondents, that was 2.5%. 2010, can't find a job, said that, you know, that was the reason why they're not working. That was 5% of all the respondents. That would be the classic definition of unemployment, which is commensurate with Alaska's unemployment rate. And the same with 2012, at 6%. The other answers vary. I'd point out that only 1% said they weren't working because of children from one-year graduates, but that climbs to 22% and then 24% in 2010 and 2006. In terms of employers, this closely mirrors what we see with Department of Labor information. Majority of people work for a company or a business. Smaller percentages work for the federal government, the state government, local government or agency. That includes the school district. Self-employed, 6%. These are 1 year out. Very similar with 2010 graduates. Majority working for a company or business. Similar percentages in federal, state, or local agencies. And for 2006 graduates, very similar. In terms of pay range, we asked this question to 2006 and 2010 graduates. 2012 graduates were, by and large, unable to answer that question, not really knowing how to extrapolate their hourly wage. So we're just looking at a comparison between 2006 and 2010. And as you can see, the longer somebody's out of school, the higher on the pay scale they go. This makes perfect sense in what we would expect for anyone who graduates from school and then develops a greater sense of independence. Longest length of employment. folks who are out of school longer have longer lengths of employment in the same place. Number of jobs held. Folks who graduated 7 years ago, 17% had six or more jobs compared to 2% in 2010, or 3%, excuse me. In 2010, 13% said that they had not held any job. Wage type and benefit. This is particularly interesting, and this also displays or demonstrates that the longer someone's out of school, the higher level of employment they attain. In 2010, 15% had hourly jobs with benefits, and 65% had hourly jobs without benefits. That ratio or that percentage of hourly with benefits increases in 2010. It continues to increase 7 years out. And the percentage of people with salary with benefits grows each year. And that's also what we would expect if someone's out of school longer and climbs a career ladder or finds better employment. In terms of education, 1 year out, 53% were enrolled in higher education, 5% in a vocation or technical school, and 7% in a short-term employment training program. That's generally offered through a place of work. We also ask whether they completed or they just attended. Almost everyone who did the employment training completed, and no participation is at 34%. That's just 1 year out, and I'd like you to keep that in mind because that changes over time. 3 years out, 55% claim to be enrolled in higher education with 6% completing. That's a 2 or 4 year college or university. So some of these folks have already completed a 2 year program. 41% were still enrolled and 8% had discontinued. Vocational technical training, 5% again. Short-term employment training increased, and then the no participation decreased slightly. The longer somebody's out of school, the more opportunities they have to have short-term employment training. And some of Mat-Su Borough School graduates delay entry into higher education or vocational technical school. 2006, we see very similar numbers. 33% had completed higher education, 10% were still enrolled, that may be graduate school, and 13% had left the program. Vocational technical training had increased from 5% to 11%, and short-term training remained essentially the same, and the no participation had decreased. So again, the longer someone's out, the more opportunities they have to experience some type of training, or they decide they want to go back to school. In terms of education comparisons, you can see those who had graduated from higher education, still enrolled, those who had dropped out across the 3 years, and no participation declined. Again, I believe that's because the longer someone's out, the more opportunities they have, and they decide that they want to do something else. There's a sense of maturity that comes with being a few more years out of high school as well. One of the questions we thought was important to ask was how prevalent online education was for graduates. For 1 year out, those in higher education, a little over 20%, 22%, had taken an online course. 20% in VocTech had, and then 32% in short-term employment training. The longer someone's out in higher education, the more opportunities they have to experience an online course. 47% of respondents from the 2010 cohort said they'd take an online course. The numbers remain very similar for VoTech and short-term employment training. And for those who are 7 years out, nearly half had taken an online course in higher ed and a quarter in VoTech and short-term employment training. Essentially, a quarter of the 2006 graduates delayed entry into some type of post-secondary education. 3 years out, again, a quarter. And those in 2012 said they would probably go, 21%. The length of delay is relatively interesting, too. 7 years out, 35% had delayed their entry into higher education by more than 2 years. And for 2010 graduates, that was 23%. It could be a host of reasons why someone would wait more than 2 years. Higher education in and out of state. 40% were out of state from the 7 year cohort. From the 3 year cohort, 35% were out of state. The 1 year cohort, 38% had gone to college out of state. in terms of post-graduation satisfaction. Do you feel satisfied with your school or work situation? 2006, 86% said yes. 2010, 91% said yes. And 2012, 89% said yes. And perception of preparedness. Do you feel high school prepared you for school or work after graduation? 7-year graduates said yes, 60% said yes, 11% said somewhat, and a quarter said no. 3 years out, 58% said yes, with 28% saying somewhat and 14% saying no. And 1-year graduates, 56% said yes, 25% said somewhat, and 19% said no. There were a number of analyses that were conducted. Well, we looked for differences between demographics, demographic categories, and schools using relative rates ratio analysis. For example, females are more likely to go on to higher education than males, but not by a significant amount. And males are more likely to be full-time employed full-time compared to females 1 year out. But again, not in a significant way. Do you have any questions at this time?
Is there Member Rutherford?
I was thinking last time we drilled a little deeper into that. Do you feel high school prepared you for school or work? Weren't there more questions that expanded
there
on that a little?
This year there were more questions about certain aspects of the curriculum, general education curriculum, post-secondary, co-curricular, extracurricular activities, and then also whether or not guidance helped make decisions. Mm-hmm. And the results were fairly evenly distributed among the categories of yes or no or somewhat. In the interest of time, I didn't include those in this, but I would be glad to provide that information to you.
I was just thinking part of this is to get data to show, but part of it is hopefully to learn something. And it seems like that question is the most potential for learning something.
In terms of what makes a difference in post-school outcomes?
What their perception is of what did or did not help prepare them for
right.
work after school.
Right.
And where they felt lacking, if they felt lacking.
Something. Well, I can tell you off the top of my head, without looking at that data, that it was difficult to discern any patterns in terms mm-hmm. of whether or not they thought general education courses or specific courses had made any difference in the decisions that they had made. I would be interested in taking a look at middle college. Is that what it is? I would really actually like to take a look at that data to get an idea of whether or not those students go on to higher education at a greater rate than general ed students. But there were a number of analyses we didn't run simply because that wasn't part of the scope of the work.
Member Welton?
I noticed we didn't specifically point out military entrance, that students going into military, where we did previously, that was a thing to look at. Is that part of the data just
it
not
is.
Presented here?
Okay. It is, and there weren't a great number of folks who actually went into the military. Those numbers remain relatively the same from the previous the previous administration. Okay. I think it was a 10% or so across the board, but I'll have to double check that.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Also, last time we noted that there was a lot of students that went on mission or did some volunteer work or something like that. Was that also a part of the data that's
here? We asked
here?
That question as well. And,
okay.
This year there weren't as many people saying that that was the reason that they weren't enrolled in school or they hadn't
okay.
taken a job.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
All right.
Did you get a sense of where these respondents live? Do they live in the state, or do they live in Lower 48?
Yeah, we asked that question, where they resided. I think, if I remember off the top, as part of the full report, I think about 85% were in-state. But that doesn't necessarily mean that our results would be any different. We don't have any reason to believe that the results would be different for employment or higher education for folks who left.
Okay. It would be really interesting to see some of the individual responses about the preparedness question at the end. So if we could, if we could get that and take a look at that, I think that's would be real informative, even though it might not, they might not be patterns or trends, but it would be informative, I think, to know exactly what kids are saying about their experiences and whether or not they were prepared for whatever their endeavors they.
This question, that's exactly the question we asked, though. Do you feel high school prepared you for school or work after graduation? So it wasn't open-ended, where they had an opportunity to say why. The open-ended questions we asked were, well, what types of work are you doing? And then we would code that later. Again, this is just a part of the scope of the work and trying to manage that greater data set.
We can ask for a full report to be included for the board, just so we can look at that, and that can be included for the board. For people online, this will be posted on the school board, on the school district's website, because all of our reports are posted on the website also. Mm. Are there any more questions from the board? All right.
Thank you again for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Stone.
Yeah, thanks again, Dr. Tarsi, and for braving the roads. Next thing on our administrative reports here is we would like to recognize some of our past school board members. And I see a couple of them out there. If I could have President Pauger go to the podium, and if I could have Representative Gaddis come on up, and also our previous board member, Neil Lacey, if he could come up. Also unable to join us tonight was Eric Hedero. I don't know if Eric joined in on a conference call. Okay. Welcome, Eric. Also, David Cheesham is previous board member David Cheesham. I guess he was unable to join us tonight. But, I'd like to start off with our previous board member, Gaddis. And Lynn Gaddis, she served about 2.5 years on the school board, and she's still working tirelessly with education. She chairs the education committee in the House, and so she's spending quite a bit of time in Juneau still working on education issues. So thank you, Lynn, and really it can be a thankless job, but she definitely put a lot of effort and heart and soul in it. And then Neil Lacey. Neil, and longtime teacher in the district, and then also came back to serve on the school board. I'd just like to say about Neil is Neil really helped give some good direction to our Mat-Su Central, our correspondent school, and also many school safety issues. And so we have Neil to thank for his participation in that and the efforts, and he also did a lot of committee work on that, and so, and also some of our policy review work. So thank you, Neil Lacey. And Eric Hedero. Hi, Eric. Eric served 2 terms on the school board, and Eric is with Lynn Gaddis in Juneau, still continuing to do work in Juneau on a lot of efforts towards education. And also, while on the board, Eric was really instrumental in helping further some of the things in the area of school choice and innovation in our school district. So thank you, Eric.
Thank you very much.
All right. And then David Cheesham served a fairly short period of time, but David, he was really a quick student on the school board and really asked a lot of great questions and got himself up to speed quickly. And so we just want to thank David, and I know he's still very involved in education and community activities. So we thank all of you for your efforts and really for the service that you've given the Mat-Su Borough School District.
Madam President, are you going to be able to send me a cake via Representative Gaddis?
I'll wrap it up for you, Eric.
Yeah, it's going to be a virtual piece of cake.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to hang up now. I appreciate it.
Member Larson pointed out to me that I didn't call for a recess, so I really don't have to call us back into session. But we will get back to our meeting now after cake. So our next item on the agenda, is the borough and city reports. And I don't see any of our city managers here. So we will move on with superintendent and student advisory board representative report, and I will ask Member Carly Williams to go ahead first.
Hi, the Student Advisory Board has not met since Christmas break, even though we did continue committee work over Christmas break, but our next SAB meeting will be next Wednesday, January 22nd, 9 to 12 at Thielen Middle School. So all of you guys are welcome to come in and see what's up.
Superintendent, Assistant Superintendent, Mr. Stone.
Yeah, thanks, President Pazier. Just want to mention that we've got off to a great start for our second semester, and you know, schools are hopping and busy. Dr. Promo, myself, and executive directors have been out visiting schools, making sure things are getting done. We've had, you know, quite a bit of activity and work that happened in the schools over the Christmas break also. So, for tomorrow we've got a weather watch, and so folks out there might be listening. We're going to be paying close attention to that so that we can have a timely decision should it warrant any kind of a school closure. Not saying that we are having a school closure. I just want to make that clear. But, hopefully I didn't jinx anything there. But there has been a forecast for some freezing rain, so we'll definitely be on top of that. Also wanted to recognize Casey Hull, the assistant principal at Colony Middle School. And Mr. Hull has been recognized as the assistant principal of the year in the state of Alaska. And that'll also warrant a trip to Washington, D.C., who he'll join in Washington, D.C., and be recognized with the 49 other assistant assistant principals. And I think y'all have a copy of MSBSD inside, and so just encourage you to take a look at that. Catherine Esri, our public information officer, has really done a nice job highlighting some of the fall and winter things that have happened in our district. So, of course, Dr. Promo is out. She's joined a cohort of superintendents in San Diego, and it's really kind of an elite group that she gets to be with, so she's representing our district there. So thank you, President Pazier.
All right, so if we want to go on to the budget update, Mr. Fult, please.
Thank you, President Pazier, members of the school board, Assistant Superintendent Stone. We basically have a budget update for you tonight. It will be high-level budget update, but also incorporate a summary of the Hay Group study, which was commissioned by the Senate Finance Committee and released last month. So we will be covering that as it relates to our budget. I will lead in with the presentation, and our Director of Human Resources, Ms. Katie Gardner, will cover some of the key findings within the Hay Group study. So just to reflect on the budget calendar, as we move forward and get closer to FY15, that would be fiscal year 2014-15, beginning July 1st, 2014. As we prepare for that fiscal year and school year, an important date within our budget calendar, now this is the current year that we're in. In November, as you'll recall, we submitted the FY15 projection due to the State Department of Education and Early Development. That was due on November 5th. And that's important because that is really what drives our state funding as it we take our ADM, as reported during that 20-day count in October, and project it out for the coming fiscal year. That count then, projected ADM, is run through the foundation formula and estimates what we will receive in terms of state entitlement, state funds. So that was an important deadline. We made that. We've already submitted our projected enrollment. Another one is our preliminary budget is transmitted to the borough at the end of March. Per borough code, it's due to the borough by April 1st, a week earlier for the borough manager to review it. And during April, a couple things happen. The state legislature adjourns, and typically education funding is decided in the final days of that session, so we pay close attention as the legislature adjourns. But also, the borough sets the minimum amount available to the school district 30 days after they receive the preliminary budget as adopted by the school board, our governing body. So within 30 days, typically what we've seen in the last few years is they set the minimum amount. That's right around $25 million. That's about half of what we've been funded by the borough. So there's an additional allowable above and beyond that minimum that we still wait for after that 30 days. And typically that will come in either May or June as the borough deliberates on their own budget and what they can afford to provide above and beyond that minimum contribution. Once we get that full funding picture from the borough, we will bring the budget back before the school board to adopt the budget prior to July. And the balanced budget, per state statute, there's a requirement that the budget be balanced. That's due to the Department of Education and Early Development by July 15th. So I just want to start there with this is kind of what we're heading into. The February meetings will be important. February 5th, our next board meeting, we will be presenting a preliminary budget to the school board that will be kind of in play for a couple months before the board has to take any action on it. So we'll have February and March before it's adopted as a preliminary budget by the board and transmitted to the borough. So that's coming in the next meeting. I want to preface the conversation today as it's centered on health insurance. I want to preface it with a discussion that the board had a couple months back when the board was approving AASB resolutions. There was a resolution regarding health insurance pooling, and the board at the time said, before we decide whether or not we want to support such an initiative, we want to know what this study, as commissioned by the legislature, what are their findings? What do they recommend? So we're here tonight to talk about that, but also put it in perspective or provide some context for what does it mean for us in terms of our budget and our structural deficit. So as you'll recall, there was a report that we made to the Senate Finance Education Task Force in August, and they basically asked school districts to come forward and asked us to present our financials so that they could gather some information across the state of Alaska as to what are the significant cost drivers for school districts. When we did our analysis, what's different about the Mat-Su Borough School District in relation to other school districts around the state is, one, we're a fairly large school district. We're the second largest school district in the state, and we provide education services for close to 18,000 students. When we look at the ADM, it's a little bit lower than that, but when you look at actual children that we serve, it's closer to 18,000 students. So we're the second largest school district in the state, but we've also had significant growth in the last 10 years. And so anytime we looked at the historical data of our finances, we had to put it in perspective of in terms of our enrollment. So we more or less had to normalize the information to say these are the costs per pupil. So each year that we looked at information, we had to divide it by the number of students we were serving because, of course, that population, that student population was changing year to year. We took total salaries and benefits per pupil and compared it to the Anchorage CPI. In all of these graphs, and this won't be the entire cost driver presentation because this board has seen it before, so I just want to forewarn you that I won't be going into that all the way through that presentation again. It just occurred to me that some of you might be worried that I'm about to do that. That was a fairly long presentation. There's about three slides that I want to cover. The total salaries and benefits per pupil as it relates to Anchorage CPI. And as you can see by this slide, over a 10-year period from 2003 to 2012, and these are all audited costs, we just received our final 2013 numbers, which are audited, but they're not incorporated in these numbers yet. We will update it in the future. Anchorage CPI, as you can see, it increased by 27% over that time period. Total salaries and benefits per pupil increased by 37%. So as a whole, we are outpacing inflation when we take the total compensation package for our employees and compare it to Anchorage CPI. We want to drill down into that number now and find out where exactly, how are we outpacing inflation. So we look at certificated salaries, and you can see that on a per pupil basis, it's not with certificated salaries that we're necessarily outpacing inflation. One of the charts that I showed in relation to this graph was our class size ratio. So you can see that over this time period, certificated salaries as a whole per pupil increased by 20% from 2003 to 2012. And we saw in the slide before, Anchorage CPI increased by 27%. So it's not certificated salaries that's driving the cost behind our compensation package. It's not necessarily with non-certificated salaries either. You can see that in this graph, non-certificated salaries are at 28%, and Anchorage CPI is at 27%. Again, I want to emphasize that this is a total expense. This does not translate into one particular teacher's salary or one particular employee salary as they move through the system. This is as a whole, and so you have to think about things like class size ratios and the number of students that are being served per period and those sorts of things. You can see an anomaly in 2007, 2008 when we outsourced custodial. When we brought it back in-house, it more or less brought us exactly where we were before. Granted, I want the board to know that this doesn't represent the additional costs the school district had in 2007, 2008. We had to move those costs to another area in our budget, contracted services. So this just represents non-certificated salaries. But really where you see the cost driver, and we presented this, and this is truly just taken from our CAFR, where you see the increase is in employee benefits per pupil. And the main cost driver within this category, granted this category makes up those mandatory benefits that are tied to salaries as a percentage, but the main component is health insurance. So you can see that over that 10-year period, we grew in employee benefits by 89% versus CPI, Anchorage CPIU, which was at 27%. So when we look at our historical data, when we look at our financials and analyze them over time, truly, our largest cost driver, our most significant cost driver, is health insurance. And I want to remind the board that 80% of the school district's operating budget is made up of salaries and benefits. So that's why I want to present those three slides for you. And during that time period, we also looked at just the cost of premiums that we're paying, and those increased by 160%. So that just goes further into showing the board that, yes, out of that 89%, a major cost driver for us was that health insurance number. When we look at our long-term forecast, and again, we presented this at the last joint meeting between the borough and the assembly, borough and the school district, rather, we highlighted some of the revenue assumptions that we were taking into account, but also, and I'm just going through this briefly, it will be posted to our website. Our long-term projection actually has been posted to our website numerous times, and so this is not new information for the board. In our expense assumptions, it's one of the largest cost drivers, and actually the one of the biggest factors that we're projecting in the future as well, is that health and life insurance continue to increase at an annual rate of 8%. And as of that 8%, 4% shared by the district, 4% by employees, because of our current collective bargaining agreement that we have with our employees. So with that, I just want to highlight, yes, we have a structural deficit. We have our expenses that are outpacing our revenues. And our current long-term forecast has, in FY15, next year, a $6.8 million deficit. In FY16, an $11.1 million deficit. In FY17, a $13.7 million deficit. Again, I want to also talk about this in relation to our revenue. In this long-term forecast, we have projected that our enrollment continue to increase over this time frame. We have projected that the borough continues to fund us at 3% each of those years. So we're projecting growth in revenue, and we still have the structural deficit. We have to, in order to really rein this in and get control of it and present balanced budgets, we have to implement austerity measures, whether we increase revenue somehow or decrease expense. So what we're going to be talking to you tonight about is possibility of or potential for ways that we could decrease an expense as recommended or referenced in the Hay Group study. And at this point, I'm going to ask our Director of Human Resources, Ms. Katie Gardner, to come forward and talk about some of the key findings within that report.
Good evening, board members. I'm going to jump back here a little bit to show you one slide quickly, and it's this one, because this really brings us to why we looked at something other than a simple negotiated solution. The school district has tried to do what it can to contain costs in terms of employee benefits, health insurance specifically, through bargaining. But what you can see is that the costs are continuing to escalate, and they're really escalating at a pretty steady rate of growth. What we've done is we've shared those costs differently, so employees are effectively incurring additional costs more than what the school district is. And that's been an effective strategy for a very short period of time. What we need to do right now is look at something that's more sustainable for both the school district and employees, and look at a different mechanism for trying to contain the increasing costs associated with health care and health insurance. So that really brings us to what got the Hay Group study started. Is the Senate subcommittee was looking at SB 90 specifically, a bill that was introduced to pool all school districts in Alaska as a mechanism for trying to contain costs on a very broad level. And when the bill was introduced, there was a need for some additional information. And so the Senate Finance Committee issued an RFP. And the purpose of that RFP was there were a lot of really specific things that the group was intended to review. But broadly, they were to conduct and provide an analysis of what current health benefits are. So to gather what school districts in Alaska are currently doing. In addition, they wanted to establish an actuarial value of those benefits so that we could compare the various plans, their affordability, and their costs, not necessarily in terms of the dollars that are being paid out, but in looking at the overall value of the plan. And then also to estimate the cost of SB 90 or something like it. What is that going to cost, and is it a cost-effective way to manage health insurance for school districts in Alaska? Hay Group was the group that was selected through that RFP process, and they conducted their survey by gathering information from a number of different areas. They started by surveying all 53 school districts. They were fortunate and noted this specifically when they presented their findings, that every single school district in Alaska did respond to the survey and provided them the information that they needed. So they had 100% participation. They weren't guessing on any of the plans offered by school districts. All school districts responded. In addition, they included other stakeholders. They interviewed the CFO with the NEA Alaska Health Plan. They interviewed stakeholders from Aetna, Primera, and some other TPAs that are used around the state. These are the primary providers, not necessarily to school districts, but in the state of Alaska, to have some concept of health insurance in the Alaska marketplace. In addition, they questioned the Department of Administration because part of SB 90 or a proposal for pooling would include management under that department. And they also gathered a lot of information and interviewed individuals from the Department of Education. That's where they got a lot of their financial data in terms of the revenue that's given to school districts. And then they also included stakeholders outside of the NEA Alaska Health Trust. There are other union trusts that are participating in Alaska school districts, not nearly on as large of a level, but they wanted to include information from a broad range of stakeholders. So they gathered information from a lot of places. Some of the information that they reported back in their final study was really kind of demographic information that showed us a little more information about what health insurance is like in Alaska. So if you're looking at the number of individuals we're talking about, this is essentially the size of the pool that may be created if their recommendations are followed. And it is approximately 15,000 employees. And one thing that the Hay Group did as we proceed through a lot of this presentation is they grouped school districts by size. And these are the groupings that they used. Mat-Su obviously falls in that final grouping of 1,000 to 6,000 employees. In that group is the Mat-Su School District, Anchorage School District, Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. One other piece of information is that not all employees in Alaska participate in the employer health insurance. There's about 15,000 who participate, and about 19,000 total employees is what they were able to estimate. So there's about a 17% of employees do not opt in. That's pretty consistent with what we find in Mat-Su. It's a little bit larger, but only a percentage or a percentage and a half. So it's very consistent there. The other piece of information that was reported is really how much money are we talking about in terms of the dollars that are spent on health insurance in school districts. So they showed that relative to total funding, and there's about $263,755,000 that are spent on health insurance for school districts in Alaska. Again, something else that is relevant when we get to the recommendations that the Hay Group provided is that if you look at all of the plan designs that exist in the state for health for school districts alone, there are 72 various plan options. One of their recommendations regarding consolidation we'll talk about later, but that's a lot of plans. That's a lot of variation in terms of what's being provided. And please stop me if there are questions as we go through. One of the other components of the analysis and that also plays in terms of the recommendations is the cost share that exists. And currently, 21 school districts in Alaska have no employee cost share, which means that whatever the charge is for health insurance, the employer, the school district covers 100% of that premium. And 32 districts have some cost share. And the average of those 32 that have a cost share is about 13%. The Senate Finance Committee asked about a national average, and the national average, including all employers, is about 20%. That's the employee cost share. But for public employers, it's about 15. So there is a difference between private sector and public sector. And so we're not terribly far off from that percentage in terms of the national average for public employers. One of the Hay Group reported that there are really three key drivers to a plan's cost, and this is something that we've talked about before and did understand, is the first is the extent to which a plan pays for the costs of care, and that really relates to the plan design. The more the plan pays for, that's a significant cost driver in terms of the expense of the overall plan in terms of premiums. The second is the utilization of those benefits by plan members. So that may relate to plan design. It may relate to other things like a wellness policy or if you've got a health reimbursement account or health savings account, sometimes that has an effect on utilization. But utilization is really the second cost driver. And then the third are the non-benefit costs. Those are the administrative costs. And that's where most of the savings that the Hay Group is reporting says that they're going to come from. And we'll get into those specifics in just a little bit here. One of the graphics that they used to really describe where savings are available, and what they refer to as the low-hanging fruit is easily seen in this graphic, where you're looking at a fully insured market and a self-insured market. And a lot of this is consistent when you're looking at pooling. So in a fully insured market where you've got individuals who are paying a premium and assuming no risk, there is about 80% of the cost of all of those premiums that are going to claims. And then there's about 20% that's built into that premium that's covering other costs. And those would be premium taxes, pooling charges. There's administrative costs, which are going to relate to either a profit, if that exists. I'm sorry, the company profits listed separate. But administrative costs and sort of claims management, the clerical fees that go along with managing the claim benefits. And so all of those are going to be encompassed in a fully insured plan. When you're looking at a pooling arrangement, you're looking at a group with a large enough size to be able to absorb some of the risk that exists in an insurance market, and you're able to alleviate a lot of the costs. And some of the costs that are mentioned here may or may not exist under the recommendations that the Hay Group noted. For example, a stop-loss premium. Depending on how many individuals are in the group, you may need a stop loss, which is a catastrophic insurance policy to cover any very large claims. But if the group ends up being large enough, stop loss is oftentimes something that can be avoided because you've got a substantially large enough group that you've got significant predictability in terms of the claims experience. And sometimes with administration costs, there's some variance there in terms of how much will be required based on the size of the group. It may not be as much as 10%. The Hay Group reported really four areas where they identified savings would be available for a consolidated pool. So if all school districts in Alaska came together, there are really four areas where they were looking at significant savings. Provider networks, overhead, which is really those administrative costs, plan design, and cost sharing. The provider networks, when they talked about that, it was really an ability to negotiate savings through a larger provider network and to be efficient in the means of doing that. That's where they reported most of their savings, and I think we've got the dollars a little bit later in the presentation. So that was by far the largest area of savings, and that level of savings stayed consistent with all of the options that they provided as recommendations. Overhead, as I stated, was really related to the administrative costs with administering a plan. Plan design is an area where in some of the recommendations we see an increase in expenses and some there's a savings, and that really depends on the richness of the plan. If the plan is going to cover more benefits than we are currently offering as school districts in Alaska, then there's an additional expense. It's not a savings, but there's a lot of variability there. And then the cost sharing was another area where it isn't necessarily a savings in terms of healthcare costs all around, but it is a savings that may be reported to employers or to school districts depending on how you structure your cost sharing arrangement. And the cost sharing is essentially how much of the premium is paid by the employer and how much is paid by the employee. There were a number of what the Hay Group called as outcomes, but basically positives and negatives to the option of consolidation or to a pooling arrangement. They believed that through all districts coming together and working under a state-managed plan, that there would be significant improvements in the contract terms for the various vendors. We would have an increase in compliance, and that it would also be easier in terms of compliance having a single individual or couple of individuals at a single location managing the plan design and the compliance components rather than each school district managing that independently. You reduce annual volatility costs, and what that really relates to is the size of the pool group is more stable when everyone's in there together, and small variations don't have as much of an effect on the percentage of participants total. There is consistent benefits for all school districts. They noted that as a benefit. The reduction of duplicative resources, which also relates to every school district doing it on their own versus a central location managing the plan and the plan design. And efficient health management. In the latter part of the report, there were some recommendations regarding plan design and wellness plans that the Hay Group recommended the state look at and explore. Though it wasn't part of the request for proposal necessarily, there were ways in which the state could explore additional savings. negative outcomes that they reported were a reduction in district staff administration, and then also it eliminates district decision-making. Some districts around the state have had concerns about SB 90, that it's taking away district autonomy and decision-making and local control. So the Hay Group did identify that as a possible negative.
Susan. Member Larson.
On eliminates district decision-making, can you expand on that? What are you talking about?
Well, right now, health insurance is something that is either set at the district level or something that's negotiated. It depends on the collective bargaining agreement that is in existence or potentially not in individual school districts. So what's envisioned in SB 90 and what's in the Hay Group's recommendations, though modified slightly, is that the state takes over health insurance and they will set the benefit levels, the plan design, there's some question as to whether school districts will have any say at all, depending on which recommendation you go with, even in what the cost-sharing arrangement will be like. So all of those decisions are basically taken away from school districts and managed at a state level. What the Hay Group talks about is the benefits of doing that, though some see the giving up of that control as a negative in and of itself. Did I answer your question, Mr. Larson?
Yes, you did. And the reduction of district staff, is that the people that are handling the claims now? Or
depending on the situation in each school district, some school districts may have very limited staff working on health insurance because they're fully insured, and so their only responsibility is going to be to process payments to the insurance company. And that staffing arrangement probably isn't going to change very much because we're going to have to do something very similar with the state. But you'll have other school districts who are, say, self-funded, and so they're going to have additional responsibilities in terms of managing the plan design, structuring committees to oversee that work. They may have a claims review process. They may have committees set up that are going to look at appeals to claims denials. There's a whole, just as health insurance options sort of run the gamut, the staffing would as well. So there were sort of five plans that were talked about, although the fifth plan was not described in any detail. It was mentioned in the report as an option that was considered, but immediately basically thrown out from consideration as it was not at all viable. And really the four plans are what they referred to as optimized program performance, which was which I'll get into next. The second plan was what they refer to as leverage Alaska care plans, and the second is really the option that's most consistent with SB 90. The third option was to centrally manage school districts' programs and standardize not only the health plan options but the cost-sharing agreements that would be in place. And then the fourth option was to centrally manage school districts with standard health plan options only. So the cost-sharing agreements would continue to be managed at the local level. Districts would have discretion in terms of setting those cost-sharing agreements, either unilaterally, if that was the employment arrangement that they had, or through a collective bargaining process, if that was in place. The fifth plan was to take all 72 plans that are currently out there and just have the state manage those. And that basically, the way that that would happen would eliminate a lot of the cost savings, so it wasn't identified as viable, and to be honest, I doubt the state would even want to take that on because it would be so administratively burdensome. So the optimized program performance, or option number one, the savings were achieved through provider networks and overhead. So basically they identified that there are significant administrative costs that exist in Alaska school districts that we can eliminate through consolidation and through pooling that go away. And they estimated those savings at between $17.1 million and $28.8 million. And I will let everybody know that these savings occur in every single plan option, with the exception of plan option 4-5. We're not even going to really talk about that one. So in all of the four options, the savings here continues throughout, because whether the state is just managing our provider networks and the overhead, or whether there's additional savings through the consolidation of plan design and some of those other features, this savings continues throughout all of the options. Now, what the Hay Group did say is that there would be a need to consolidate plan design About 7 plans, which is more than we'll find in the other options, but 72 plans is a lot. And what they found is that though there are 72 plans that have small variances, the true value of the plans is very consistent. So it would be relatively easy to consolidate the plans that exist into seven various designs, and that would cover most of Alaska school districts for the most part in what they're offering. There may be some very small variances, but for the most part, 7 different plan designs is going to cover everything almost exactly. In addition to the positives and negatives that we already talked about in terms of pooling in general, with this plan, there was noted that cost savings is going to exist even with the same level of benefits. So that if people are particularly tied to a certain plan design, that plan design can continue. What they noted as a benefit is that there's a simplification to bargaining, and not necessarily collective bargaining, but the bargaining process with the vendors and with providers, and the cost savings that can occur through negotiating when you've got such a large pool that you're talking about. There's a lot of weight that goes with bargaining on behalf of this many employees and even more covered lives, so that there is an additional ability to find savings in your negotiating with providers. Another positive that was noted here was that districts would continue to be allowed to set contributions rate under this option. But one of the negatives, and what was mentioned, is that in this plan, and really in all of them, there will be additional administrative burden that is on the state, so it does increase the state's administration. The Hay Group did provide some information to estimate what they believed that cost might be, but was very hesitant to say that was a definite, as they had not vetted that through the Department of Administration to find out exactly what their needs would be to manage the school districts coming together into a single pool. And to some extent, it depends largely on which option we go for, whether they're just talking about provider networks and negotiating for school districts, or whether they're talking about managing various plans as well. So the second option that was recommended was to leverage AlaskaCare. And this is basically taking all school districts and rolling them into AlaskaCare, which is the state of Alaska's health plan. This was a little bit different in that there is the potential of an increase of $8.7 million in expenses for school districts versus and up to a savings of $34.9 million. So there's a very large range in terms of a cost estimate here. And basically the reason for that and what Hay Group reported is that they don't have an ability to say what employees are going to do if given the option in plan design. And right now AlaskaCare has 3 plan designs. They have what's called the economy plan, the standard plan, and the premium plan. And if every employee goes to the premium plan, which is the most expensive, and we do not make any adjustments into the current cost-sharing agreements, that's going to cost $8.7 million more to school districts. If that's not the case and more employees go towards the standard or economy plan, then there is a potential for savings. But they were not necessarily willing to make an estimate on what employees were going to do. And the premium plan under the state is a richer plan and it is a more expensive plan. So if everyone goes to that premium plan, there is an expense for that, especially when you consider a lot of the plan designs that exist in school districts in Alaska are significantly lower in terms of richness and in value and in expense than that premium plan.
Member Larson.
Is there a difference in cost for the employee with the state from the premium plan on down? I don't understand why. I mean, I know it costs the state more, but doesn't it cost an employee more?
It does cost employees more. That's why part of the study did say that there should be set cost sharing that exists if we go to AlaskaCare. And what they recommended was zero cost for employees at the economy plan, 5% at the standard plan and 15% at the premium plan, I believe, is what they recommended.
So it
is not likely, and they said this, it is highly unlikely that every employee is going to go to the premium plan. Highly, highly unlikely. But with all transparency, they wanted to make sure that people understood that if that were to happen, yes, there would be an additional expense that would be incurred. So there is cost sharing that exists, and yes, you're right. Not only is the amount of money more, but the Hay Group proposes that the percentage split also increase with the richer plan.
Just one follow-up. If they suggest a 15% save for that premium, does that bring down that 8.7 mil cost?
No, I believe that's included in the 8.7 million.
Okay.
I think that is with the cost share. The third option, which is the option that the Hay Group recommended, this was what they suggested that the state strongly consider, is basically taking all school districts in the state of Alaska and creating an independent pool for them. So separate from Alaska Care or the state plan, but create a school district plan for all school district employees. And they recommend that there be three standard plan options that exist. They talk about what those plan options are, and basically they developed those plan options by looking at the various plans that exist in Alaska. And so they found designs that they believe adequately cover the range of options that are available for most Alaska school districts. But the savings in this option is between $22.6 million and $33.7 million. The other part of this plan is that it's not only the plan design that's to be standardized, but it's the cost sharing as well. And the cost sharing under the three plan designs is the same as essentially the three plans with Alaska Care. The what they refer to as the P25 plan, the lowest plan, would have a zero cost share for employees. The middle plan would have a 10% cost share for 5% cost share for employees, and the high plan would be 15%. So it's the same cost shares.
Katie?
Yes.
Just a minute. I was wondering if in this plan they're talking about charging more for a family. I know right now if our members have their family on, they don't pay more for their insurance. Does this include an extra cost for families, if you remember?
I believe that it does. I believe that they had an employee employee information and family information, but I can verify that and follow up with the board.
Member Rutherford?
And also whether that additional family is the same cost share split, the 0, 5, and 15.
Right.
The additional family premium, or if it's different cost share.
The deductibles and the maximum amount of pockets, I know, are differentiated in the plan design. What I think is different is the tiered structure, where the single plus one plus children family, that's the typical four tier. I'm not positive if that is built into their recommendation, but I can follow up. But there are definitely differences in terms of the deductibles and maximum out of pockets, which is what our plan has now. That's what I've got to check on.
Okay.
So the positive outcomes that were reported here, basically that there is a cost savings, but with different benefits, and that all districts have the same contribution. So the Hay Group reported equity as a positive here, that equity across the state would be a positive. Negative is what they call a disruption in plan design, which means that there are going to be changes in the plan designs for different school districts in Alaska. It may not be much, but there will be changes likely. And the other negative that it reported here is that there is restricted bargaining, and I believe in this since they were talking somewhat about collective bargaining.
Cost savings but different benefits. Does that mean that I would assume the main trust of the benefits stay? You're talking different fringes, or are you talking the whole benefit package changing?
They did not provide a great deal of detail regarding all of the plan design options. What they did share was the deductibles, the maximum out-of-pockets, and the co-pays and the drug benefits. And those are substantially the same as what exists now. But, for example, I believe that there was a $200 individual deductible for the high-end plan, and we have a $100 deductible currently in our plan A. So that is something that would change. But in terms of the coinsurance, it was largely similar. It's an 80-20 share. The fourth option is very close to the third option. The only difference here is that there is no savings that they can pull to from a standardized cost share agreement. So basically, it leaves it to districts to set what the cost share is going to be unilaterally, if that's the employment relationship, or mostly through a collective bargaining process. So the savings here looks a little bit different because they've not noted any change to any cost sharing agreement. So you can see that there's a savings of $9.4 million to $64 million. And really, it's the same positives and negatives to some extent. But the only difference between this and the third option is related to the cost-sharing agreement. It provides discretion to districts to continue to set that. And what the Hay Group reported was that option three is their preferred, is what they would strongly recommend. But option four is a viable alternative that could be considered as well. I got a little bit ahead of myself, I guess, in what the recommendation is. But another key part of the Hay Group study, and they stated this several times throughout their recommendation, is that none of this is really valid, and none of this will work if it's optional. This is kind of an all-or-nothing situation, because the savings that you are pointing to and earning is through the size of the pool and through the consistency of the pool. So they draw a close connection between a plan that exists right now for municipalities, a pooling option for municipalities. It exists in a voluntary nature. The problem with that pool is you have people who come in and leave and come in and leave, and not individual employees. That was talked about very differently, but employers. So you've got groups of people that are coming in and leaving the plan, and when you've got such inconsistency, you have a difficulty establishing predictability in what the plan's experience is going to be. And when you don't have a large enough pool, you really can't be predictable. So what they stated was that in order for the savings to work, as it was reported, it's not that there's no savings available if it's not mandatory, but in order for the savings to be as they've predicted or reported it, it has to be a mandatory option, which means it has to be something that happens through law, through the legislature, that requires all school districts to participate. Are there any questions I can answer, or additional questions I can answer?
Member Larson?
I got a question for Luke. I didn't know we could ask questions during his presentation. So if that's possible, I'd like to ask him a few questions.
Okay, but keep it quick, please.
Keep it quick. You said the major cost driver, and through your slides and through everything, is health benefits, and we have a 50-50 split now, whereas our employees are about 87% for the school district, 13 for the employee. Is that correct on the...
Member Larson, through the chair, yes, it's 87.7% for the school district and 12.3% for the employee.
See how good you are in math. So if it stayed 8% for the next 3-4 years, how far down would it get, say, in 4 years?
I'm good at math. I can't do that at the moment. But
would it be like 2% a year?
It'll work its way down. It'll exceed 15% relatively quickly. And as Katie alluded to, that's what the Hay Group sees when they look at public sectors across the U.S., I believe, is what they said, is 15% for the public sector, and they normally see a 20% cost share for all employers. So we would be approaching that very quickly with the current contract language that we have in place. And I think the other point that I want to mention, it was related to a question that was asked while Katie was presenting, was the tiered structure and the premium. If we and I didn't see it either. And so we have an opportunity to ask some questions of the Hay Group. We just received notice that the week of January 27th, the Hay Group will be providing a informational meeting and update to superintendents and business managers in which we can ask questions. They haven't scheduled a specific date for that, but we will be able to take these specific questions and ask them more detailed questions about how they came up with their numbers and what types of assumptions were made within their actuarial modeling. But with regards to the premium structure, if it went to a family, child, spouse, employee, self, tiered structure of the premium, then you're disaggregating the premium costs. And so while families might be paying more than our composite rate currently, employees who are not married would be paying far less. And so you don't, there's not really a savings for the group. It's just to the individual. It's a different way to structure the premium for the group, but there's no savings derived from that setup. It's either a composite rate or it's broken out based on the number of dependents that you have as you enroll within the program. So we will ask the Hay Group more about that specific detail within their study and how it relates to their recommendation of option 3 when we're able to meet with them on the week of the 27th. But are there additional questions?
Yeah, on increase, health care increases in a pool like this, is it less or is it about the same as normal? I mean, will it increase 8%?
I suspect that most of the increases that we see, and Katie can speak to this as well, but most of the increases that we see nationally are driven from just industry cost of the service. So whether we're in a large pool or we're members of NEA Alaska, we will see large year-to-year annual growth within the health insurance industry until something changes within that market. But this will bring the cost down initially, and we'll continue to grow as we were. I don't see the annual rate not being where it's at. But with the pooling, you do have, as Katie mentioned, some of those cost-saving factors that won't be increasing year to year because we don't have them.
If
or
I
wouldn't
may,
have them.
Just two more questions, I promise.
I'd like to give Member Welton a minute. Right. Member Welton.
I know this is going to sound a little strange, but just in your envisioning of this process here, would then the state just pay our health insurance, we would never see the money and it would just go, or do we would get the money and then we'd have to pay it back and there'd be administrative costs and things like that on top of it? I'm just kind of curious as to how you envision that would happen.
I can answer this. Member Welton, through the chair, I envision that nothing would change in terms of the revenue that districts receive. We participate in state-managed plans as it is today. We participate in both the TERS and PERS system, in which we receive funding, enroll members, and make payments to their pension plans. So I see, this is a bit speculative on our part, but based on and the two, the study doesn't necessarily recommend what's in Senate Bill 90 as it currently exists, as the language in Senate Bill 90 as it currently exists, as Ms. Gardner mentioned, that was option number 2, and they recommended option number 3. So there would be some things within the bill that would change, but currently in the bill, there's no indication that the foundation formula or the operating revenues that school districts receive would be decreased by any method or means. So I would assume that we would receive our funding and we would pay the premium.
Okay. Any other members have a question before I return to Mr. Larson? Member Michelson.
I may have missed this, but how is the decision-making structure for this with all these options? I know that Hay Group is recommending option number 3, but do all the school districts get together and choose which option? Does the state choose that? How is that? Or is that articulated in SB 90?
Go ahead.
Right now, SB 90 is the piece of legislation that exists that would change this whole structure. And so SB 90, as it's written, is a little bit different than Option 3. So if the state legislature was interested in Option 3, they would need to modify that a little bit. But it would require a legislative action to put this in place, either SB 90 or exactly what's in Option 3. Although I will say that when this report was... The Hay Group's report was presented to the Senate Finance Committee. There were a couple of members of the committee that sort of pleaded with the audience and anyone who was listening to provide them with feedback. So they asked for administrations and school boards and stakeholders to consider this information and provide feedback to the legislature with what option, if any option, that stakeholder group really wanted to see put into legislation.
All right. Member Larson.
A state-mandated program, which this would be, would it be easier, I assume it would be easier, since it's state-mandated, if the cost went up in health care, that the state would look at that and... possibly fund that like they do. They're self-insured anyway. State employees are self-insured anyway, and they pay that cost every time, don't they? Every time that increases?
Through the chair, yes. I mean, I think that, Member Larson, to answer your question, it would be a lot easier for the state to track those health care costs and know what the year-to-year increase was to potentially... inform the funding for schools. So if school districts came to the state and said our healthcare costs are growing year to year and this is what's happening based on those costs to our budget, it'd be very easy for them to see that data because they would be managing the plan.
Yeah, because right now our biggest cost driver is healthcare, and we go down and tell them that, and they don't, it doesn't register because it's not a state mandated program, I assume.
Yes, and to answer your question, they effectively had to commission a study, the Hay Group study, to find out what are the costs across 72 plans across the state of Alaska and 53 school districts. So it's not easily gathered. It's not a required object code within the state uniform chart of accounts. So that's actually, when I presented the financials for this, I presented salaries and employee benefits because our audits only capture that level of detail. I had to drill down further because it's optional coding. We use it, but the state has no way of getting to the health insurance line item by just going to our CAFR. So you're exactly right. It's a little bit harder for the state to see this information. They had to commission this report in order to get true health care costs across 53 school districts and, as Katie mentioned, 72 plan designs. But if they manage the plan, or manage the pooling and state-managed plan, it'd be very easy for them to see the costs that school districts are incurring with health insurance.
Okay, one last question on your presentation February 5th on the budget. Are we going to look at, $8 or $9 million deficit? Because you have to present a balanced budget and all those unknowns such as the borough increasing 3% and transportation costs and all the other monies are not going to be there. So we'll look at a pretty heavy deficit budget when you present it on the 5th.
Through the President, there will be a deficit. We will be presenting a deficit. Based on our current long-term forecast, we were projecting a $6.5 million deficit. We'll be revising that number based on our enrollment as we count it, as we recorded it for the current year and have projected it forward for FY15. So there will be some changing of some numbers there. But it all depends on how much of our reserves the district, the board, would like to obligate to cover expenses for next year. So the deficit is very much dependent on the board's decision as to how much in terms of the reserves that we have will be obligated for next year. But we'll be presenting all of that and make it very clear to the board.
All right. Do any other board members have questions for either Ms. Gardner or Mr. Fulp? All right, I know it's a lot to take in. Thank you. Our next section is the bond project update, and I see our borough guy here. You'll need to say your name for me because I don't remember. Thank you.
Madam President, I'll just do a brief introduction.
Okay.
We've got Mike Brown, our Capital Projects Director, with the borough, and he's here in place of Jeff Walden to give us a presentation on bond projects as they stand today.
Well, good evening, and thank you for the opportunity. Thanks for the intro, Luke. I will try to keep my public math down. I don't think I'm quite as smart as Mr. Fultz, so I'm going to try to keep that to a minimum as far as throwing around those numbers. As he mentioned, normally Jeff would be here. He will be back with you. He's on vacation, I think, probably on a nice, warm, sandy beach in Mexico at this point, so here I am. So he'll be back with you at your normal, regular bond update with, I think, we're going to the second meeting in each month. Also, before you, real quick, before I get started, there's a graphic in front of you, an 11 by 17 handout. If I could just orient you to that quickly. Really, it's just for your information to take away. What we're trying to provide is a comprehensive overview of all the various projects that are out there. That map, because the same folks manage public facility, other public facility construction outside of just schools, I've also included that on the map. But it does give you a rundown of all the school bond projects as a whole that are out there. What I'm going to talk to you tonight is just the ones that are currently in progress. So you'll see how the labels correspond. I think it's projects 12 through 22 in your labeling system are district-wide projects. So those are a little bit harder to depict with every school that's involved. So in order to keep the map something that you can digest, we didn't label those. So you'll see that those numbers are missing for a reason. And that map is also available on the borough website. So we're going through some changes there to make that available so the public can find that online as well. With that being said, we'll go ahead and get started. Again, I would like to say I'm relatively new to the borough staff. I'm on about 3 months now. And one of the things that I was very impressed with when I came on board was the relationship, the good working relationship between the two staffs. Particularly our project managers, your operations and maintenance folks, as well as the administrative staff here. So I was very impressed by that, and I think that continues to be a very good and healthy relationship as we move forward. Tonight I will give you a project review of the school bond projects that are in progress, and I'll talk to you a little bit about the upcoming projects starting here in 2014. One thing I would like to mention along those lines is we're in the process of kind of going through the future bond sales. With our finance director, Ms. Clayton. She's out of state, actually, at a road bond closure, sale closure at this point. But Mr. Walden, her, I, and then our purchasing division manager will be sitting down and kind of doing the synchronization of various contract awards, bond sales, so that we can line all of that up as we move forward this calendar year. I'll start off with Valley Pathways. Design team on that is MCG, along with Collins Construction. We're currently just over 50% complete in construction on that project, and that is currently on schedule for a 2014-2015 school year opening. Matsu Day School, design team there, Wolf Architecture with FE Contracting on the construction side of that. That one is also approximately 50% complete in construction and is also on schedule for a 2014-2015 school year opening. Career and Tech High School Edition, MCG also has the design contract for that. We're currently at approximately 65% design. Anticipate construction starting this year and with an occupied date in the 2015-2016 school year. As far as Reddington Senior, Junior Senior High School, the design team is currently Wolf Architecture. We're currently at 80% design. And that one is scheduled for an occupied date in 2015-2016. The construction contract award for that goes before the assembly next week. And as some of you were aware from the joint session, there was a great deal of dialogue about the alternative delivery method associated with that. We do have a work session in advance of that meeting. And at this point, frankly, I think that will go relatively well. And I don't expect to have any issues associated with that. As far as Denina Elementary School, the design is Bettisworth North. Actually, Mr. John Steele's here tonight, and you'll be seeing the 35% design review here in a few moments. So, and he will also be providing that presentation to the assembly next week. That is on the agenda as well. We anticipate construction beginning late this year, And then we do have a new delivery date in the 2016-2017 school year. And actually, from my perspective, very pleased to see that. I think that does a lot for us in terms of giving us the flexibility to do, to deliver you a quality school within budget. As far as the next one, Iditarod Elementary School, the replacement school for the current Iditarod Elementary School, probably see that advertised more like February of this year. So here next month, we should be able to get that out on the street for a design contract. That one is tied to some of that bond funding availability that I just discussed a few minutes ago, that we will kind of set up the timing for that. It impacts tax rates and a number of different things on the finance side for the borough. So we just need to sit down and kind of line all that up to make sure that we time the bond sales at the correct times. And again, looking to occupy in the 2016-2017 school year. Big Lake Elementary School renovation. At this point, that is substantially complete. It did come in a couple of weeks behind schedule. And there are some miscellaneous cleanup items that will take place during the evenings and weekends over the course of the next month. But at this point, we are at the point with, from a construction perspective, where they can move into the admin and administrative areas and the classrooms. As far as some additional projects, instead of going through each one individually, the Palmer High School mechanical upgrades contract award approval to FE Contracting will go before the assembly on February 4th. The Houston and Palmer Junior Middle School locker replacement was completed over Christmas break. And then the backup generator switchgear district-wide project design award approval to AMC Engineering goes before the assembly next week as well. And then those remaining three projects on that slide for district-wide flooring replacement, Trapper Creek Elementary and Willow Elementary roof replacements will see construction during the summer, or we're forecasting them for summer 2014 construction. And then lastly, some of the other additional projects that are out there, the restroom renovation and wash basins is currently advertised for design. The athletic complexes at the four high schools, the turf fields, there's some striping that needs to be done. Obviously, those are nearly complete, but when spring comes, we'll finish that up and close that out in its entirety. And then there are five additional projects that are pending requests for proposals that will be going out here in the springtime. For the five projects that are listed there, four of those are the district-wide projects, and expect to see the Houston High School exterior upgrades being done sometime this summer. So subject to any questions that you may have, that concludes the update.
Member Dearman.
I'd just like to say that on the way in, the drive-in from Talkeetna today, I stopped by Big Lake Elementary to see what was the progress there, and the school is beautiful. The upgrades look amazing, and I had the opportunity to visit with Principal Simon for quite some time, and he took me around and showed me the improvements that have been made, and they're just waiting for that glass in the admin area there to keep the secretaries warm and everything, but it looks so much different than it did a few months ago when I was there, so job well done. It looks very nice, and it's going to be a great school for the students there, and they're very anxious to get into their new building, so
thank you.
Member Rutherford.
I just wanted to give you kudos for this map. This is great. It's the first time I've seen anything like this come out of the borough, and it just really, I think, will help the public wrap their arms around where all the projects are, how much is going on. I think that's great. And I also had a Palmer Junior Middle School student thank me for the new lockers after break, said that he could now reliably leave things in his locker. Before, he couldn't even rely on it locking appropriately, so he never left anything there. So we got to thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
All right. We're moving down to the consent agenda.
I'd like to move the consent agenda. Item A, minutes December 4th, 2013. Item B, 14-056, high school graduation qualifying exam waivers. Item C, 14-057, permission to apply for 21st century grant. And item D, 14-059, recommendation for certified new hires.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any objection to passing this? Seeing no objection, the consent agenda is passed. Moving down to action items.
I'd like to move action item A14-037, second reading, board policy 6146, graduation requirements 2016 and 2017.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak on this item, graduation requirements? Come on up and state your name.
My name is Tim Walters. I'm a teacher at Wasilla High School, and I'd like to speak against raising the graduation requirements. And honestly, what folds into this is a return to the six-period day, away from the seven-period day. Some of you remember the implementation of the seven-period day several years ago, how a majority of teachers felt it was bad for kids and bad for education. We conducted a survey of high school teachers within the district, and many of you saw that survey when it was released. I can assure you that the results haven't changed and teachers' views haven't really changed. New members, I'd be happy to get that survey to you. From the start, classroom teachers understood that decreasing instructional time with students and increasing students' workload would not help teachers build positive relationships with students or cram more material into their heads. If we want to build relationships with students, teachers need time to spend with students in classes. Shaking hands and honestly just capturing kids' hearts are all nice and good, but it doesn't make up for losing class time. We're professionals. We know our jobs and we know the classroom environment well. We need time with students in class. When the six-period day went to the seven-period day, the late Dr. Burnley was asked what would happen if students started graduating in 3 years instead of four, and his response was, what's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with that is that we're losing money because of it, and the seven problems of the seven-period day continue. So what I'd like to ask you is to please not raise the graduation requirements for the class of 2016 and 2017. Please move the district back to a six-period day and allow students to experience a more normal, sane high school atmosphere. Please don't fluff up the graduation requirements to make up for a bad decision several years ago. Let's fix the mistake and not compound it. Thank you.
Is there any other member of the public who would like to speak? All right. We haven't had an administrative report on this for about a month now. So is there an administrative report?
Yeah, actually, President Pauger, I do have Mike Vervelo, Executive Director for Instruction, that's available for questions if there are any.
Okay. So if we have questions, we can have Mr. Vervelo answer those. Otherwise, we're moving to discussion. Is there any comment on these items? Member Welton.
Just refresh my memory, Mr. Stone, as to the reasons for adding more courses has to do with being able to comply with the new scholarships and things like this that the state has, as well as just requirements for other programs. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and let Mr. Vervelo, he's prepared to speak about that.
Through the president. Yes, it does put us more in line with the APS scholarship. I think that's what you're referring to. It's a 4x4 schedule for the APS scholarship. And when you're on a seven-period schedule, the kids have more credits, thereby giving them easier access to meet those requirements than if you're on a six-period day.
Member Welton.
I have a couple of questions that just are ancillary to this. Students who are taking, say, Alaska Middle College, are the credits for a college course the same as the credits for high school, or are they different? And I've got those questions. And then what if somebody is on schedule to graduate, like, in 2015, but something happens and they have to go to 2016, then they would they would be under the new requirements and add another credit or half credit or whatever the actual schedule is.
Through the President, Member Weldon. The answer to your question on Alaska Middle College, it's twofold. If students are on the high school side, they would receive the traditional credit, just like any high school student. If they're on the college side, and let's say, for example, they took a Math 107 course, they completed that within the semester, they would have the equivalent of a full year's credit.
All right. Member Rutherford.
When civics became required, did we increase the credit requirements, or did we just shuffle them around?
We increased the credit requirements for the class of 2016 and 2017 to 3.5 credits for those two classes. The class of 2014 and 15, which would be our senior and junior class, they do not have that as a requirement.
Member Williams.
Do the new credit requirements allow for the same amount of classes to be failed and retaken as the old or the credit requirements we have now?
I would say that with the recommendations, you would have additional ones. Let me take that back. If you still had it at 22.5 and you'd left it at that, you would have kids would have more opportunities, I guess, to fail and still graduate. With that same thing being said, if you left it at 22.5, kids would only have to take three classes their senior year to meet the graduation requirements, and then they could graduate at that time.
I was just asking for, like, is it the same ratio out of the amount of classes that we can take and the amount of classes that are required of us? What's the percentage of which we can fail and still graduate?
Last time, and when we used to be at 21 credits and we were on a six-period day, when there was 21 credits that you were required to have out of a total of 24, it was 87%. Moving it to 24.5 credits with a possibility of 28 is 87%. So proportionately, the ratios are the same. You're correct. Thanks, Jane.
I do have a question. My concern is I want to keep a higher number of students graduating. That's our task as a school district, is to graduate students. Besides, giving them an 87% completion rate and giving them that little bit to not complete courses, when our students don't pass courses, and I know there are some students who struggle when they're freshmen and maybe don't pass but one or two classes, what are their other options to make up those classes if they fail a significant number, have a bad year, and fail a significant number?
Well, they have APEX courses. They can retake the courses. They can go into what we would call a double dip. So if you failed an algebra class, you can go into a additional math course to help supplement that. And that was part of the benefit when we went to this. We had staff reductions at the time. I think some of you remember that were here. And so to accommodate those reductions and still be able to maintain kids being able to make up a course that they failed, to be able to get a double dip so they could have two math classes with a lab, to support that. This was part of the idea behind having those additional offerings for kids to be able to meet those needs.
Okay, and just to keep it clear in my mind, I know we have many fifth-year seniors. Once they get past that fourth year at school, we don't kick them down the road. They can come back and register again and go to school until they complete their credits. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Member Larson.
I assume we have increased the APEX to the summer, so the kids have, if they have failed courses, they can go into the summer and pick those courses up. And if they are wanting to pick up some baseline courses or courses so they can have more options when they go into it, in other words, they can come into the summer session and take those courses also, and they're not failing it. They're just picking it up to have additional courses, additional higher courses in their winter session. Now, I guess where I'm going is, have we increased that ability over the last couple of years where kids can do that in the summertime?
Through APEX, and Mr. Stone may want to add to this, I would say yes. Our summer offerings, I think there's more flexibility with APEX and kids that would want, that could take those in the summertime. I think throughout the year, we've advanced what we've done before through other credit options, whether it's through Matsu Central or APEX. Kids have additional ways of obtaining credits than they would have, say, a decade ago. So I think there's a lot more flexibility in our educational system for kids to advance for advanced classes as well as for credit recovery.
One follow-up, too, if I may. Has our online courses increased also, and are they on an increase? Like, not a bell curve, but a straight curve, or how do you see that, I guess? Can you look into the future a little bit on that?
I don't know if Mr. Stone wants that. I would say they've definitely increased over the last few years, and I think we'll get better and better. I think as technology increases and our ability to offer those types of courses online, we'll see an increase, a steady increase. I think it's a common expectation in colleges and other high schools throughout the United States that kids know and how are comfortable with working on online courses.
Yeah, through the President, Member Larson, I just wanted to add, last year, we exercised about 800 licenses. This year we're looking at about 1,300 licenses, and all of those are filled currently. So to answer your question, yeah, it's been significant.
Member Rutherford.
I apologize if this was answered in the slideshow last month, but in the presentation, the credits that we're adding, they're not designated under a specific curriculum area. So they're under electives. So, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And unless, like Mr. Vervelo had mentioned, if you want to qualify for the performance scholarship, then basically you have to satisfy the 4x4 design. But there definitely gives opportunities for more career tech opportunities, more general elective opportunities, and then also substantially more opportunities to add for added support for AP courses as well as our intervention courses.
Go ahead.
So my real question is, students going for the scholarship are self-motivated to fulfill the requirements of that performance scholarship regardless of what we're telling them they need to do. Same could be said for some career tech who want to achieve a certain certificate in a career. They're motivated by that more than what we're telling them to do. So I'm a little baffled as to why we need to increase the number of credits required when the bottom line is, if you pass all your classes from the beginning, what we're telling you is you have to take, and you maybe you're not motivated to do the performance scholarship, we're telling you you have to take two more electives before you can graduate, which, as opposed to the student who might instead want to get a job the last semester of their senior year. I'm just not sure why this is necessary.
I would say the reason for the increase, when we raised it, when we went to a 7-period day, kids have an opportunity now, or they will get received 28 credits. If we don't increase it, those kids, their senior year, all kids on a standard model that have passed their classes, would have to only take 3 courses their first semester. They wouldn't have to go into second semester at all. And if we raise it to 24.5, which we're recommending, those kids still, if they passed all their classes, would still not have to go second semester. They would complete it there at the end of their first semester if they're on track. What it does, though, it really, if we were on a 6-period day and on track for the 22 or the 22.5 credits that we're currently at, this recommendation is actually less of a percentage. Those kids currently under the 7-period day with the 24.5 recommendation have much more room
to take additional classes, to fail class and repeat if they need to, than they did previously. And I was here when we increased and we asked the board to, for the civics class, and I was real concerned to move to 22.5 as well as the principals, because it was starting to really get tight for kids. When you talk about graduation rates, dropout rates, there wasn't much wiggle room at all. When we're looking at 24.5, we're going back to the 21 to 24 ratio standard we had years ago, which gives kids much more opportunity to repeat a course if they need to take additional supplementary classes. And if they're an advanced student, it gives them that same room. So it's really going back to a standard that we had for decades around here proportionately. We're not asking to increase that to make it more difficult for kids. It truly gives them the flexibility they had before we ever increased to 22 or 22.5 credits when we're on the six-period model.
Member Williams.
You used the example of a math intervention class. When you're looking at the credit layout, would a math intervention class count as a math elective or count as a general elective?
I think it is a math elective. And I'm going to have our curriculum counseling secretary person come up, Janine Sparks, for a second, because I just don't want to misspeak, and I know she knows this stuff really well.
It depends on the class, and most of the intervention classes for math would count as a math credit, but it would depend on it, the course. So,
Member Rutherford?
So this ratio you talk about, of course, is assuming seven periods is here to stay, which is increasingly a statewide conversation that needs to be had, it seems. And nothing means, if we change that we couldn't change the credits again.
That would be correct. We could adjust and modify these if we went back to a six-period day. These credits recommendations could be modified just as fast as they're being recommended right now.
Member Welton.
Serving on the board as long as I have, I know that in the past, whenever we went to increase the number of credits, we also had to increase the cost. I don't see a cost measurement for this. And usually we get some kind of notice at the introduction to the action item that says what the cost will be. In I think it was 2004 or 5, we were going to go up to 22 credits, and it was going to cost us $4 million, and we couldn't do it, and so we immediately passed it and then went back and didn't and rescinded it. And so I'm just curious as to what the situation is and whether there's just more course offerings that, and we're not actually going to hire more people, or how this is going to come together.
Great question. And I remember exactly what you're talking about. I was a principal at the time. And at the time, there were content. They were asking to increase in content areas. And as a principal, we knew we would have to hire more staff to accommodate those specific needs. And I can remember going back to the Office of Instruction and saying, with other principals, we can't do this without additional staffing. The recommendation, that's partly why we've left it in general electives. We worked with counselors and principals over the last year trying to come up with this recommendation. And when it's in general electives, those kids are currently already in classes. All we're doing is saying we need to have that standard down the road to where they meet that level, so that, you know, we're on a four-year model. Our typical graduation as a high school kid should be in our high schools, we believe, for 4 years. If we don't increase that on a seven-period day model, literally the first semester of their senior year, take three classes and they're finished. And so I guess specifically to answer your question, we don't have to have a monetary increase because they're general elective classes as well as cores and double dips and all those different things that we're talking about. Those kids are currently in our schools in those classes right now. It's not going to have a cost associated to it.
Member Dearman.
I wasn't going to weigh in on this, but I feel compelled to. having been a teacher and taught both in a six-period day and a seventh-period day in a high school, I can see the concern on teachers' parts, and I understand where you're coming from. I agree that we need to spend as much time with our students as we can. But I also learned from my experience to modify the game plan and make the absolute best of every moment that we did have with those students. And that's what I did, and that's what my colleagues did. And we made the seventh period work as best we could. Fortunately or unfortunately, it did not last in Miami-Dade County schools very long. But having said that, I would like to go back to something that happened earlier this evening when Dr. Tarsi gave his presentation. And I have to wonder if the group, the percentage of students who said that they felt that high school did not prepare them enough to go out into the world, well, maybe this seventh period day and asking for more credits and allowing them to explore more of the classes that the MATSU has for them and getting them out of their comfort zone and what is dictated to them to take, so they have to go over and maybe sample a vocational class or sample something in the arts or sample something new and innovative to them, won't make them feel more prepared after they leave the school and give them an awakening to something that they had thought that they may never be interested in, and give them a path then that they had never even considered. So I, from the teacher side of me, I think that this could be a very, very wonderful thing to compel the students to look further than here and go out and have another taste and see what's out there for you. And I don't think that when you leave school, the more you have in your bag when you walk out the door, the more knowledge you have, the more classes you've been exposed to, the better person you're going to be when you leave. And I think this is a good thing.
Okay, are there any other school board members who have a question? Member Larson.
I just want to follow up on school board member Derriman's comment.
Is it a question? Because we'll go on to comments. All right. We are finished with questions. Go ahead and have a seat.
Thank you.
Member Larson, now you're following up.
I just want to follow up. I apologize. I just want to follow up on that. It seems like we've been battered quite a bit over the years about not having an adequate education for our students, on and on and on. And I just want to compliment Dr. Dearborn's comments, and I agree wholeheartedly with that. Those extra credits to explore into some areas that that you've never been before can really open up everything from career tech to a new and different area that you wouldn't think of as an adult. It expands it, and I think that's where we should go. And given over, because we've been accused of not giving a overall or a rounded education, and I think this will achieve that area.
Any other school board members who would like to make comment? Member Williams, what do you think on this subject?
I am slightly conflicted, because I know that I've heard a lot of students who would encourage a credit increase, but I've also heard students, though they're a minority, that say that they would not encourage a credit increase. So it's kind of balancing the student opinions and my own opinion. Although I would have to say that for the benefit of students, I would encourage a credit increase, at least to just encourage students to explore more while in high school, while we do have free education, so we're not exploring college, and to to allow students that chance to not just get enough credits to graduate, but to, you know, get enough experience in our social lives, to become more mature so that we aren't leaving school when we're 17, but when we're 18 or 19, so we have that grasp on reality. So I would encourage this credit increase.
Right. Member Michelson.
You know, this seems like a necessary action or reaction to a decision that was previously made. So I'm really not thinking of support or non-support for this in terms or through the lens of a seven-period day versus a six-period day. So to me, it seems like a necessary action item that needs to be followed through with. And then if there's some further debate about the seven-period day and all the benefits or the drawbacks that may or may not promote, it would be for a different topic or a different time or for a different discussion, I think. But staying focused on raising the mandatory credits for graduation seems to be a necessary thing to do at this particular point. So that's all I have.
All right. So just one comment from me before we go to vote. I have never had a complaint for a parent that we taught their student too much when they were in school. So I will be voting to increase the graduation requirements. So Member Scott.
Can you clarify?
A yes vote would mean you agree with increasing the graduation requirement.
Yes.
Member Michelson.
Yes.
Member Welton.
Yes.
Member Larson.
Yes.
Member Rutherford.
Yes.
Member Dearman.
Yes.
And I too vote yes, so graduation requirement increases. Thank you. I would like to take a 10-minute break here, and we'll come back at 35 after. All right, we are down to action item B. Okay, we're trading. All right, so this moves us down to action item B. All right. Action item B, can I have someone move that for me?
I'd like to move action item B, 14-043, K-12 math curriculum.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak with to action item B, math curricula? All right, we did have I'm sorry. Go ahead and come on up.
Okay, Angela Phillips, Thielen Middle School, but I'm here as a parent. I'm not sure what curriculum you're looking at, but my middle daughter, all three of my girls were dyslexic and had problems in reading, but they went to Cottonwood Creek Elementary, and with Saxon Math, they were able to excel in math, even though they were non-readers, they were dyslexic, started reading in fourth or fifth grade. My middle daughter just graduated from University of Colorado Boulder with her doctorate in atmospheric physics. She was a resource student until fourth grade. She couldn't read, but she could do math because it was Saxon, and it was math. It wasn't reading. And why make it so that the kids that are non-readers have to struggle at math because there's a lot of reading? So as a parent, I love Saxon math. So anyway, thank you.
All right. Is there any other member of the public? All right. We did have a report, but that was over a month ago. So if we can have someone give us a little update.
Okay. Yeah, if I could have Becky Murphy, our curriculum coordinator, and also Monica Goyette, our executive director of instruction. They've both worked together on developing this.
Go ahead, ladies.
At this time, the update is that we are still in the process of having the final approval of our curriculum. And just for the sake of those who are not well-versed in what we've been doing, just to give you an update, what we are asking for approval tonight is on the actual written curriculum, which is the standards, the objectives, and the teaching examples and instructional supports. It is not actually the program. We are in the process of vetting that program, and that will be taking place in the second week of February. At that time, we will be having an open house where parents can come in and leave commentary on, like what we just heard, the testimony, what they feel is appropriate for our district. So we do have that timeline coming up so we can have our final approval of which curriculum program will support our curriculum, let me say that way, by the end of February. So that, like I reported before, is that the reports that you've received so far are on the written curriculum, and we're going into the materials adoption now. So that will be coming up probably to the school board the beginning of March with the district's recommendation for which program we should use in elementary, middle, and high school.
Now, is there going to be an announcement for the public so the public will know that the material is on display?
Yes, absolutely. That will be coming out, and we'll be posting on our website. We'll be posting newsletters at schools. We will also be sending through Board Connect that you will know when the timelines for all of that process happens. But that's not coming up till about the middle of February. All
right. I also want to add that in our rubric, one of the factors when we're looking at instructional materials is parent friendliness, that parents can help their students at home with math homework, because some of our programs that we've chosen in the past are harder for parents to help than others.
Are there any members from the school board? Member Rutherford.
I already mentioned this privately, but first I want to say, wow, this just was very impressive, this curriculum that you put together, the written materials, the detail of the standard objectives, and the detail in the examples. Really, really, I was impressed. But I cannot emphasize enough how important this next step is in community relations, because as educators, the vernacular is so day-to-day to you and to us somewhat, but to the general public, especially the 75% that doesn't have kids in a school at any given point, they get confused between curriculum and materials that support curriculum, and that's part of our whole problem with Alaska Standards and Common Core. People don't understand that the standards are state or national, but the materials are a local decision. It is their opportunity to weigh in on the, instead of the what, but the how we get there. I just had a parent complaining about the Common Core is requiring every kindergartner in California to have keyboards and electronics. And I said, I'm guessing that was a local decision. I don't think it had anything to do with the standards. And we need to reach out and get that public input and help educate them and be careful of the terminology that we use when we ask for that input, because otherwise it'll come back to bite us.
Any other board member have a question of the ladies? Okay. So thank you, and we will move on to discussion. All right. We're moving on to discussion. Anybody have a comment on this item? Are we all feeling comfortable with it? All right. I'm going to ask for Ms. Williams' advisory vote, if I could. Member Williams?
Yes.
All right. Member Dierman?
Yes.
Member Rutherford?
Yes.
Member Larson?
Yes.
Member Welton?
Yes.
Member Michelson?
Yes.
And Member Scott?
Yes.
I, too, vote yes, so this new curricula passes and is moving on. We're down to non-action items. So with non-action items, we're not voting. So We would like to move right forward with Dena'ina Elementary School, 35% design approval. And Mr. Fulp, will you introduce our guest?
Yes, thank you, Madam President. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. John Steele of Bettesworth North. Bettesworth North is the firm that's designing Dena'ina Elementary off of a basis of design, not a prototype, and he can explain that further, but off of Mokattam's Elementary as a basis of design. So he'll get into 35% design development and go through some of the timeline that's occurred thus far and also show you some renderings, conceptual or potentially even schematic. I don't know if it would be considered schematic, but of the school thus far. And so designs began November 19th, or meetings began November 19th with tours of Mokattam's Elementary and workshops following. And here's John Steele to explain the rest.
Good evening, members of the board. As I was introduced, my name is John Steele, and I'm the project manager with Bettesworth North for the Dena'ina Elementary School. And I'm going to follow along pretty much what was in the reference number 7 in terms of the slideshow. I will note that there was an earlier version that has been published, and the slides that I have before you, the correct name of the school is being used. I made an error in that as the manager, I looked at the contract, and the contract was labeled Kinnick Area Elementary. So if you'll pardon my oversight, the slideshow does correct this. As pointed out, we started very recently. We were selected to do the design in early October, and in preparation for the interview, we did quite a bit of research, which founded our basis of a lot of information gathering even before we were selected. So from day one when we became interested in the project and wanted to work on it, we started an in-depth research of the site, of the climate, the area, understanding more about the school. So that has also given us a little bit of a heads up as we start into a very compressed time schedule for the design. Now, what we started with was the considerations of the Mokattam's Elementary School. And as we started the process, the intent was finding out what is good and making it even better. And so that's been a guiding light in terms of our efforts with the process. We started with the interview of asking the questions of what makes a successful elementary school. And we have assembled a team with a depth of expertise in relationship to educational school design. We, as well as the lead firm, have a lot of Alaskan experience in school design. So we started eliciting from the committee, the interview committee, as well as the building committee, what are important elements. And here is a brief listing of some of the elements that were brought forward during the interview process. Again, these are points of reference that we are always going back to and ensuring that we are responding to these type of issues, because we find that the success is founded in what the interest of the people is and what their goals are. So that's our commitment. Through the process, we've also itemized a list of other important issues that have come forward. We certainly have to address budget in the design. We want to make sure that we're spending the dollars wisely in terms of educational delivery and spaces supporting that. So again, these are some more elements that we are committing with our efforts in design. We started the process on the 19th of November with what we called the kickoff meeting, formally with the borough and the school district representatives. And you can see a listing of the various meetings we've had. We had a very intense period of the initial design efforts through mid-November through the holiday season. And I want to first thank everyone from the school district side that participated. It was a process that was well attended, and we benefited greatly from their commitment. But the slide that you see up before us is just examples of some of the plan options that were discussed and developed during an intense workshop the first 3 days in December. The first day was a tour of Mokattam's Elementary School, interviewing the previous and current principals, again, trying to find out what was working well and the like. But throughout this whole process, we've ensured that we are touching base as the design develops to get the appropriate response and input. Now, what you have before you right now is the slide of the from the educational specification that was developed for the school. We've completed both schematic design and educational specification simultaneously. And the way we were able to achieve that, again, was having the direct involvement of the Matsku School District, the instructional side, informing the program needs and the types of spaces for the school. So this particular slide is showing a very similar balance percentage-wise. I think there's only a 1% deviation between the mockatons in terms of percentage that you'll see between the prototype components. And these components are listed, the 1 through 7, and are spelled out in the bar graph or the pie chart to the side. So, again, in taking mockatons as a school that is beneficial and highly regarded and wanting to be replicated here, our focus was on ensuring we had the prototypical elements as part of the design. Excuse me. Now, key to that is with the Denina Elementary School, it is smaller than the Mockatons Elementary School, smaller in both student population and area that's permitted by the state of Alaska in terms of the project agreement with DEED. So we had a project that was 53,000 square feet for Mockatons, coming down to 44,000 square feet for the Denina Elementary School. So for our starting point, we had to look at the ways of achieving that, and we came up quickly with some focus of reductions that have to be made. Some of it is attributable to the change in the student population, which makes the square footage change. The rest was discovered in looking in these other categories of efficiency and making sure we're giving the proper program provisioning. The Mockatons School is what you would call a three-session or segment arrangement. It has a total maximum capacity of 534 students. And you can see the classroom structures. It has K through 5 with three grade levels, supplemented by the special ed, some flex areas, and applied learning classrooms. So we started with a model of the 400 capacity for the Denina school, and so it's reduced in terms of the number of classes for each of the grade levels. And again, this was all discussed and agreed upon with the instructional side as we developed the ed specification and follow on the design. Now, here is a slide historically of the Mockatons ed spec diagram, if you will. And this is what we refer to as the programming protoparts. And you'll see, again, those kind of key elements that are the focus of making the success of Mockatons and the need for the school. And as we get further into the presentation, you'll see these same elements. I'll kind of highlight those in the design that we're proposing for the Denina Elementary. Now, we also, as we toured the school and heard from instructors and the principals, that there are some benefits in the school and some good points, and there are also some items that we should pay attention to in terms of our design. And this is just a smattering of what those elements are. One is the after-hour access and use. Right now, the way the Mockatons design functions, it pretty much mandates that the entire school is open if, for example, the gymnasium is used in the evenings. And a lot of that is due to the access points, locations of restrooms, et cetera, and exiting requirements. So as an example, we ensured that the layout for the Denina Elementary School afforded the opportunity for the gymnasium to be used after use or after hours and back off the balance of the school in terms of lighting and heating, saving energy, and finding a more usable solution for the school. So it has those kind of flexibilities that I'll point out. The other was the number of entries and the control of the entry, and I'll go through those as we get to the Denina school layout. Now, As part of our analysis in both preparing for the interview and as well as afterwards was taking a look at the context of the community, the Kinnick area, and taking a look at utilities available, what has to be extended, taking a look at the access to the school. And then as part of that is recognizing that really the elementary school is a piece of a campus, if you will, the campus being the middle high school that's being designed and will be developed shortly, as well as the elementary school site. They do share a boundary, so it's important to try to look at this in terms of equipment, fixtures that are selected. There may be some logic to have commonality so that from a maintenance point of view, you're not having to run back and forth with different types of, whether they be lamps or fixtures, if there needs to be maintenance work or repair. Having similar types of systems in operation will also be a benefit. So we're keeping those in mind and working with the project manager, with the borough, as well as the Wolf Architecture Design Team in terms of integrating the appropriate campus response. Now, we also got into extensive analysis of the site, the topography of the site, the drainage, solar access. We looked at the wind directions, more specifically the winter winds, so that the placement of the school would not have issues with kids getting blown down at entries, that there would be a play area that could be buffered and be used and protected from the winds. The classrooms had a solar orientation, both from the natural light point of view, but as well as just the warmth that can be brought into the inside, which is, I think, important part of the educational facility and the feel for the school. So from that, we developed the current site plan. And the current site plan, if I'll go back, is in the same orientation as this particular diagram, with north being up on the page. So all of our access right now is being proposed from Kinnick Mudshack Road. And I keep wanting to keep saying, and give your doggy a bone, you know, the limerick. But bringing the access from Kinnick has been established as the important part. And so we've separated access to the school site for bus and staff and service access, which is the far north access, which is aligned with Carolyn Drive. The alignment is made across from Carolyn for logical traffic layout and control of vehicles coming and going to the school. Now, further down to the south or towards the midpoint, we have a separate access for parent drop-off. That was one of the important elements to be able to have a convenient drop-off and access for parents dropping off students. Currently, we don't have access off of Clay Chapman, but so that midpoint access will be parent drop-off, and if a parent is dropping off, they would continue through the loop drive-through. If they were a visitor to the school, they would make a left-hand turn and park in the visitor parking lot, which is the lower portion on the site. Now, the dark shaded block is the school proper. The main entry is at the right-hand side of the school. So all of the access is served from the main access is served from the parent drop-off and convenient from the visitor parking. The staff would have an access path into the administrative block from the north. Also, there would be the benefit of the gymnasium having that same access point after hours. The play areas are to the south of the school, and we've zoned it for the type of play, the level of grade, and also having varieties of surfaces appropriate to the playground elements. We're looking at fencing the site. That fencing is to basically stop the moose traffic that would be wandering through so that you're not having a situation of the students in the play area. And again, the last piece is that the upper left portion of the school is the service drop-off. So all of the deliveries to the school will come to that point. Maintenance and service will come to that point as well. Now, the organization, the play area, is sheltered by the building from the northerly winds and has the solar access. Now, the particular design of the school itself you'll start to see some of the commonality of the mock-a-tons. We have the bar of the classroom spaces, which are the purple bar that has the jogs on the bottom, but it forms the southern boundary with the southern access. In the center, we have the common space, which is your main entry, circulation, as well as multipurpose for the school. Then to the north bar, we have the administration right at the main entry. So we have a single point of access that during the start of school, the students come directly into the school through a vestibule. After hours, you would come into that vestibule and have to go through the administrative area before you could be let into the school. So there would not be the casual entry and access to the school. Once it's in session, you would have to check in with the administrative area. So its location is primary to serve that, as well as being the greeter and the observation for all the bus traffic, visitor traffic, et cetera. As we move to the left in that north bar, we have a music room, which will also be a performance space that's oriented to the gymnasium in the center. Moving again a little further, we have the service area, but between the gym and service area, we'll have adequate PE storage, as well as a food service area with the reheat meal type of service at the elementary school. Right now, the service would be from the commons space. The school, I should point out, is a two-level school, similar to Mockaton's. We have stairs at both the right and left of the there's a stair right to the bottom of the main entry, and then at the far end you have the second stair between the two floors. On the first floor we have the preschool and kindergarten, and then we have the some flex spaces, and we have additionally we have a resource room, and we have intensive needs area as well. We've also captured a feature of the Mockaton School that was highly desired. Outside in the common space, where we have the offsets in the classroom bar, we have little nooks or areas where you can pull out or break out from the classroom and actually have, say, a table, some informal learning, just some flexibility in terms of the educational delivery. Now, going to the second level, you can see it's much more sparsely colored, and the reason is the music and the gymnasium are a two-story volume. The admin area, which is to the right on the first floor, is overlaid with the media center at the second floor. And the media center is next to it has a dedicated computer lab, and it has the support spaces along the north edge for the media center operations. The classroom bar is repeated at the second level, and these are, again, for the upper grades. Again, we have some flex spaces, the nook areas for breakout, so again, some flexibility. There are punched openings in the floor plate between the first and second floor, so along the classroom bar is a continuous walkway or circulation. And we have bridge crossings that go to the north bar, serving the media center, and then at the end where we have the restroom facilities. Otherwise, we're having the overlook similar to Mockaton's, being able to engage the kind of the dynamic of that center commons with both levels, engaging them within the activity of the center of the school. Now, the elevations that I'm showing here are to give you just a sense of the scale and proportions. Later on, I have some rendered massing diagrams, which I think will inform you much more in terms of the design. But our goal is to limit the palettes that we're introducing. We're looking at not having a wide range of materials that we're trying to display here, but keep it to a cohesive, limited palette that works well with each other. Use materials that are very durable, have low maintenance considerations, but yet give it a feel of a warm and inviting dynamic. Now, what you're seeing here are the gray areas, not intended to be cold, but just to identify that those were looking at a metal panel type of finish. And you see those used more on the north side, which is the kind of the high volume service side of the facility. And as you come to the entry and around the south, we're trying to introduce a product that has a warmth or a feel of wood. Now, we're not specifically going to wood because of its high maintenance and durability, but we're looking at products that are a synthetic simulation or a bonded wood product that is very, very durable. It's a product that's been around quite a while and has a very good performance rating. And so that's our initial palette right now. These things obviously need to be explored more and finalized with the superintendent and the operations and maintenance folks before any final decisions are made. But what we're trying to keep in mind here is that keep it a minimal palette. We're putting a base of a cement block all around the buildings where they have a contact with the ground and maintenance and students. It's a more durable material that that will withstand any of the wear and tear that you normally see. Now, these are the interior sections, and they're hard maybe to follow, but if you look at the school, the two-story classroom block equals the gymnasium, admin, media center stack. So we're trying to keep some very simple geometry to help with constructability. So we have two elements flanking the center space that is a little taller in volume, but the volumes of the two outer flanking pieces are compatible so that the structure systems are very straightforward and simple. That should reflect in some simplified volumes for both constructability and the economy. Again, trying to focus all of our money on the educational space that we're providing. Now we'll get into the renderings of the school itself. This is a bird's eye view of the main entry, or the east side of the school. You can see to the right the media center atop the admin block. So you have the main entry coming between that glass-lit stair tower and the media center admin. The stair tower we're suggesting be glazed as it is to kind of provide that beacon or that interest for both the student and the parents visiting the school. It's kind of putting on display that this is the school, this is the main entry, and kind of keying that view. You start to see in the center the taller volume being popped up where we have clear stories we're suggesting to bring light into that center commons area. Now, the extent of glazing has not been identified at this point, so these are very preliminary drawings. Then you start to see to the left the classroom block and the kind of the playfulness of the windows and the openings between the classroom and the southern exterior. This is turning a little bit more to the north where you see the gymnasium block and the service to the far right. We're suggesting that the gymnasium have some high glazing, again, to bring in some natural light into the gymnasium, some connectivity. This is a little closer up view as you're starting to get a better sense of the scale of arrival at the school. Again, the administration with the media center above. This, unfortunately, is a little dark, but it's reflecting kind of a woodish tone on the classroom side. And you can start to see a lot of color and variety in the glazing. Again, these are just placeholders or suggestions or starting point. But the idea is to make this facade the more kind of dynamic, exciting, playful type of treatment. This is the playground view. This is the view the students are going to be seeing coming in and out of the school. On the left-hand side, you'll see the second stair, which is at the far west end of the school. And again, a shot of the main entry of the Denina Elementary School, accented with some colors that are yet to be determined, but it's, again, trying to represent our goal of making this a inviting and exciting facility for the borough. Now, as we move on, we'll be back to present the 95% construction documents to the board again, as well as the assembly. In the interim, between where we are now and this 95%, we'll again be working closely with the school district, the building committee, and operation and maintenance. Obviously, following the completion of the construction documents, it'll go to project bidding and award and construction. And following that, of course, would be the move-in for the school. So that's a very kind of quick overview, and would entertain any questions or comments.
Is there any questions from board members? Of course, Member Larson.
Two questions. Number one, of course, you're taking, and this isn't to you probably, this is to the staff, we're taking a prototype off of Mockingtown, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I know the people at Mockingtown, I've talked to them. I haven't heard any complaints, but I have never heard, is Mockingtown an efficient, energy efficient, and movement of student efficient elementary school? The reason I say that is because back in the 80s and 90s, a prototype was like Finger Lakes Shared, Pioneer Peak, and now we've gone to this prototype. So my question is, is this a more efficient building? And maybe it's to staff to come up next time to discuss. Is this a better design layout for elementary kids than, say, Pioneer Peak and the rest of those, and more efficient, et cetera? I've heard that Mockingtown's an excellent school, but nobody's actually come up to the board and said, it's working, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you're going to take a protocol off a brand new school that we've never had this design in our district. And I just kind of would like to hear staff maybe tell me it is a working facility.
Certainly, I think it would be more appropriate to kind of get that historical background. Just a quick comment relative to the response of the Mockingtowns is we have a much different site and a much smaller school. So that also was in play in terms of developing the design. We feel very confident that it's a very workable and exciting type of space for education. Now, I don't have the experience with the depth of other schools, the benefits that other plan designs have and the like. So ours has been totally with the direction that Mockingtowns was the basis of design, if you will, for prototypical elements, and so that's why we're here.
And the second question is maintenance. I assume maintenance and has been actively involved in this because you went over the classrooms and the gymnasium in the front, but not really over the maintenance area. And is it going to be a functional area and not an area that I've seen where if something goes out, you have to tear a wall to get it out, that kind of thing.
I will dedicate my commitment to not seeing that type of element. And I think part of the building committee that we're working with consists of people with operation and maintenance, headed up by Mr. Anderton. And it's been very beneficial hearing from them and getting their input and comments.
Well, I'm glad that they because they're the ones that have to maintain it. So thank you.
I agree.
Member Rutherford?
I have a question and a couple comments. And one of the comments is actually from a parent this week. The Mockingtown School, I believe, was a LEED certified building. Is that in play at all here, or does it?
We are designing to LEED Silver in terms of the U.S. Green Building Council. So we're following the commitment of the borough and the district to developing projects that do recognize energy efficiency and the importance of sustainability. So it's a key part.
The kitchen service is facing the multi-common area. Will they eat there or go back to their classrooms to eat? Or what was your?
I think in most of our schools they do go back to the classrooms to eat, but probably the reason they designed it this way is so that they can have gym class even throughout that extended lunch period.
Mm-hmm. We were hearing that, and again this is using Mockingtowns as a point of reference, that they do have their meals within the classroom setting. They also have, in the gymnasium, which we're replicating, our pull-out tables. Now, those pull-out tables still have an advantage and benefit, and that is for other functions other than the dining itself. We debated at length, and it isn't resolved at this point, whether we should have access to the gymnasium for service, the multipurpose, or both. where it was last left with input is access or service from the, to the multipurpose room was the more desirable at this point. So as we explore the designs a little more, that'll probably be a point that'll have more conversation.
Yeah, I know it's mixed at schools right now. Some eating in the gym and some not. So this last part was a conversation with a parent this week. Obviously, you take into consideration the northern climate, the realities of northern climate. And the two things that were brought up were, I love how it's south-oriented in the because we love our light here when we have it. But, of course, along with that light comes weird sun angles. Mm-hmm. So being able to block that sun right in your eyes is just as important as having the sun.
I agree.
There have been some places where they had to, after the fact, retrofit because the sun was becoming a problem because it comes at such a low angle part of the year. And the other one was the realities of little kids in puffy coats and wet snow pants and big, huge backpacks and boots and shoes and all that stuff. And a lot of our schools, granted, are have a lot more kids in them than they were originally designed for, unfortunately. I mean, mm-hmm. in the classroom,
right.
The classroom size, empty classroom here, 30 kids here. And, the closet space is not designed for that many kids, and in my opinion, wasn't really designed well to begin with, considering, it's like someone never had been in an elementary kid classroom and had a bunch of eight-year-olds come in after right. recess with wet stuff, have to hang it all up in that tiny little space, and it's a mess. Things fall. It really is a mess. And it just seems like we ought to be able to come up with something better.
I agree, and we haven't finalized solutions to this, but the model we're looking at is QBs with boot storage and the like, and that is a starting point where Mockingtons is. But we certainly need to make sure that we're understanding what the population is, because it doesn't make sense for quite a few of them to not have those provisions. Mm-hmm. And what is provided has to be at the right heights, the right scale and size. So it, again, is a very early point in the design, but this next step is to interview more with district personnel and get this resolved, and it'll address both population as well as needs. So,
Member Michelson.
I thought I heard you say that you were going to come back with a 95% completion.
Yes.
Is with previous projects, do we stop at 65% and see any kind of a report at 65%? It seems like a quite a leap from 35 to 95.
If I might, and this is, needs to be probably more informed both with the borough's facility folks, but right now the only approval stages with the board reside at the 35 and 95 as well as the assembly. We're still intent on having a 65% or design development submittal that will be fully detailed and priced, and that will be reviewed by the building committee as well as the school district. So I think it's just a matter of probably informing how that, if a presentation is needed or how formal that gets. But there is that step. I mean, that is a big leap to make without appropriate kind of comment and input. And so right now the discussion has been to have that with the building committee and in-house school district as well as borough personnel. But.
Member Williams.
For clarification, the library will be included in the media center?
Yes.
Okay.
It'll consist of a space that's large enough for probably a classroom setting, an instructional setting. It'll have a stack area. It'll have informal reading area. It'll also have checkout areas, what you would more expect with a traditional library. We're still going to explore and look at the options of what a library means these days. It's a constantly changing element, but it will have all the features and pieces expected.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any more questions from the board? All right. Then thank you so much for your presentation.
Well, thank you for the time and the opportunity.
Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair, I'd like to
since I believe a lot of the people are here for the resolution, I would like to request that we move the resolution up to right now.
Can I have a second on that change?
I second it.
Okay. It's been asked for to move and seconded. Is there any objection to moving that forward on the schedule? All right. Seeing no objection, then we will move forward. If I can have someone bring item G.
It's non-action.
Okay. So we don't even need to bring it forward. All right. So we're moving to non-action item G. It's the resolution 14004, health insurance pooling. We have had a presentation on that. A lot of times we don't have public comment on non-action items, but I'm going to ask for public comment time. If there's any members of the public who would like to speak on this, go ahead and come forward.
Thank you. Good evening, members of the school board, Superintendent Mr. Stone. My name is Joe Boyle. I'm president of the Mat-Su Education Association. I rise to speak tonight in order to encourage you to consider carefully before you endorse the resolution before you. Under our current system of employee insurance, your only liability is the premium negotiated with our various bargaining units. Under SB 90, all liability shifts to the state and by extension to you. Those liabilities include stop-loss insurance, management of reserve funds, payment of medical bills, and adjudication of all claims. Right now, we take care of all of that through our Public Education Health Trust and at an administrative cost of less than 4%. Under SB 90, those liabilities become a government problem, and by extension, your problem. I don't believe that the politicians in Juneau can do a better job of managing my health insurance than we can. As a member of the Public Education Health Trust, we choose coverage, work to control costs, and manage our own affairs. If the state takes over, we lose all of that. But the district will still be on the hook for the bill. From startup to shutdown, every insurance company needs reserve funds. A reserve fund can be balanced, in deficit, or in surplus. At the Public Education Health Trust, through careful and conservative management, we've been able to use any surplus to hold down our current premiums, the cost of our premiums. Last year, our third-party advisors recommended a 10% premium increase. Our trustees, two of whom are in this room, recommended that we use some of our surplus reserve to buy down that increase to 6%. Do you really believe that first, the politicians in Juneau will be able to build up a reserve surplus, and second, that they would use that surplus to hold down the cost of our health insurance premiums? I saw how they mismanaged the defined benefit pension program. I have no faith that they would manage an employee insurance plan any better. And who pays the bill when the plan gets into trouble? The first bill comes to you. I'm going to skip forward so I can finish before the game clock runs out. According to Ms. Gardner earlier tonight, SB 90, under its current form, could not accommodate the recommendations of the Hay study. Doesn't that make any resolution premature? Shouldn't you see the bill in its final form before you decide whether or not you're going to endorse it? Thank you.
Hello again. My name is Tim Walters. I am a teacher at Wissahila High School, and I am also a trustee on the Public Education Health Trust, formerly the NEA Health Trust. I'm speaking against the proposed resolution to support SB 90 health care pooling. To be honest, there are political games being played and a tale that's being spun with the promises of SB 90 and the Hay Group study. The promises are somewhat disturbing and I would say, honestly, less than accurate. Before the board considers supporting this any further, I'd encourage you to sit down with teachers and representatives of the Health Trust, listen to a presentation, and let's separate some fiction from reality. A state government takeover of health insurance in SB 90 would do nothing to control the actual cost of health care. The state already spends over $1.8 billion a year on health care. They should be able to pool costs already, but they don't. And many districts have left expensive state plans for the Public Education Health Trust. SB 90 will require significant startup costs that the district, us, will have to pay. A state government takeover of health insurance will remove local control from our school boards and employees. Districts and employees will get what the commissioner decides they will get. In fact, I think that's the exact language out of SB 90. There will be no choice. There will be no control. The Public Education Health Trust insures educators across the state and does an exceptional job at it. Our overhead is at or under 4%. The state is at 10%. We're well run, responsive to our members, and we control costs. In fact, we've negotiated contracts that are better than what the state already has. We do our job so well that principals and mid-level management have joined the trust. And I'm sure if you have some private conversations with those principals around the district, you'd find they're pretty happy with the health trust. Please do not support this resolution. Give the health trust a call, and let's sit down and discuss insurance and separate fiction from reality. Thank you.
Angela Phillips, Teeland Middle School. It was interesting listening to the take on Senate Bill 90. One of the things that I took out of it is that it's going to grow just like any insurance plan. The costs are going to increase, and that there's no district option. It'd be like going into a restaurant and sitting down, and instead of being given a menu, you're being told, well, it's the chef's choice. And, yeah, there's going to be some meat. There's going to be some vegetables, and there's going to be some potatoes. Okay, there's a meeting that they said that's January 27th. I would suggest that you table this until after that meeting where you can find out what the options are that they're going to give you. It may not be a good deal, but they said it has to be mandatory, all districts or none. So I would say let's hear what they're going to present. Thank you.
Is there anyone, any other members of the public who would like to speak?
I'm Jim Rink, and I'm with I work at Mattsu Central School. Plus, I'm a parent. I looked at a couple of things. I looked at the Hayes, the group report, and I was sort of wondering what they were talking about, because when they talked about the evaluation of the pharmacy benefits on page 3, and, you know, with the NEA Trust, they had the VSP for the vision on it. And we've had no, I mean, it was just seamless. You wouldn't know who was providing that, whether that was any Alaska Trust or another separate entity, whereas the Hay Group is saying that there's a difference, but it hasn't been for us. And then also on page 3, they talk about the overhead of the broker revenue, about who's selling the, who's handling the insurance. And that's not really our problem, who's handling the insurance, who's selling it, because you're going to be comparing the benefits and the cost. And if the costs are too high, then you're not going to have it. So it looks to me like the Hay Group is sort of maybe looking for a particular group of people to furnish the insurance. And then on page 4, they're talking about plan design, and it looks to me clearly that they're going for high deductibles versus low deductible insurance. And, you know, depending on what kind of insurance you're buying, I mean, with health insurance, you definitely want the low deductibles on that. So I would really, if you're going to do the resolution, either state that you're for SB 90, or you need to really say that you're not for SB 90, that you're looking for a way to cut insurance costs with a pooling. So you need to probably really look at differentiating what you want to do on that. And then on SB 90, when I looked at that, I just stopped when the commissioners were the ones that said who got what percentage of the premium that they had to pay. It's like when they did the teacher evaluations, it's like 50% of the student performance on the SBA test is going to go and say how well the teacher is doing in the classroom. I mean, and a lot of people spoke out against that, but what they went to is what the governor wanted. They didn't go care about the public input. And I think this is what you're going to end up with SB 90, too. The commissioners are going to go what they want to do and not what is really the right thing to do and right for the workers or the school districts. Thank you for listening to me.
Hello. My name is Tracy Martin. I teach second grade at Meadow Lakes Elementary School. And I have definite concerns about SB 90. One of the main concerns, they've pretty much already spoken about it, but one of the things I think you really need to consider is that the Public Health Education Trust is not for-profit. So they're not looking to increase their shareholders' take-home pay, which if you use any other company that's out there in the market, they're not looking at trying to save you money. Their goal is to increase their shareholder profits. You really need to think about that. Often insurance companies will first dangle a little carrot out there for you to get you to bite, and then they increase your costs or they reduce your plans. That's how they make money. That's how it works. I play that game with my car insurance. I go and change every 3-4 years because I take those carrots. And I wait for the rates to increase, and then I switch. And that actually has been the past with districts, but that's what they were doing and why the Public Education Health Trust, which is now called was the NEA Alaska Health Trust, was created because of those same exact problems. So I think you're just going to go back to an old problem. So don't support this. At least get the information and talk to our CEO, Rhonda Kidder. Have her do a presentation. Thank you.
Are there any members of the public who want to speak? All right. We'll move on. We've had quite an extensive presentation, but I'd like an administrative report also.
Yeah, if Assistant Superintendent Business is Luke Volk.
Thank you, Mr. Stone, members of the school board. The resolution that's brought for you before you tonight is a first reading of this resolution. But I want to be clear that nowhere in the resolution does it specifically support Senate Bill 90. Nowhere in the resolution does it specifically support option number 3 under the Hay Group study. What it does support is the concept of a state-managed consolidated health pool. And so you can see in the final portion of this, and as we referenced earlier, again, this is us bringing this resolution back before the school board because when it was originally discussed as a part of the AASB resolutions, the school board did mention that they wanted more information and wanted to see what was determined through the Hay Group study. So being that the Hay Group study has made a determination and a recommendation, we drafted a resolution for the school board to consider, and I'll just read the final conclusion of the resolution. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District supports the legislature's efforts to contain health care costs for Alaska school districts through pooling or other solutions under a state-managed plan. So nowhere in here did we say specifically Senate Bill 90 or a specific recommendation within the Hay Group study. It was referenced and cited the Hay Group findings within the resolution, and it's brought before the school board for consideration and first reading at this point.
Do we have any questions from the board for Mr. Folt? Remember, this is questions, not debate. Okay. Go ahead, Member Larson.
There is a House bill also, isn't there, not, that goes along with this? There's a Senate bill and there's a House bill. 160, is that what it is?
Through the President, I do not know the legislation of the companion bill. I'm not familiar with the exact title of it or the... cannot reference it off the top of my head.
There is a House bill, but I do not know the number either. But there is a companion House bill on this one. Any other questions? Okay. Is there any discussion, any comments from the school board on this item? Member Welton?
I don't know. Be careful of Greek sparing gifts, I guess. I'm concerned that this offer is one way to continue to defund education. It will take out the money, and we won't give you any more. I would like to see that there be a better way to do health insurance. The cost is astronomical. It goes up and up and up. And I've heard of people recently who were uninsurable before who now have gotten insurance, and I cannot believe the plans they have. They're so much better than our plan. My personal plan that I had to go out and get because I couldn't be on the NEA. I think that there's better options out there. I don't want to, trash the NEA plan, but I think there's some better options out there that are much lower cost and are better for us. If it takes pooling with the state, we might have to do that. I'm just concerned that what will happen is, well, we're helping you, the state says we're helping you by reducing your costs, and then we're just not going to give you any more money either. And that's not the situation is that we need more money, and it would be great if the insurance was reduced and they still gave us enough to increase our education staff so that we can decrease class sizes. I think our class sizes are so incredibly high, and I think we need to be looking at where we can save money, and if there's a way to do it, that might be, the health insurance is a way to do it, but I'm afraid that we may go for this and still not get the funding that we need, and that it, in the end, there may be cost increases in 5-10 years that still eat up everything. So I think we need to be careful. We need to look into it. I know that between now and when we have to vote on it, I'm going to be checking around. I'm going to be asking. I'm going to be talking to people. It's part of my duty to do that. I hope the rest of you will also do that. Thank you.
Member Larson.
I agree. We also have to do something, because if we do nothing, looking at the projections that Luke put up are pretty dire. I mean, you're talking in 3 years, $11 million in the hole, and the cost driver being the health care. So where I see this resolution, and I will do... I've read the Hayes study, and I'll be reading it and asking more questions about it. The resolution says that it'll support, at the end, what he wrote, supports the legislation effort to contain health care costs for Alaska school districts. Right now, there is no effort to contain health care costs, because health care costs are going off, anywhere between 8% and 11% every year. No fault to anybody, but we've got to figure out how to stop that structural deficit, because there is no money, additional money coming into our budget, so that means staff reduction. So I guess we're in a catch-22, but I look at this as maybe an alternative, maybe something we should look into. Maybe it's something that, will help. If NEA can come up with a different feasible plan, I look forward to that, and I'll be talking to them also to see what they have. Thank you.
Member Williams?
For right now, I feel like there are so many questions circulating around this topic that I would feel, I know it's a non-action item, but I would feel uncomfortable making a decision quite yet. I feel like there still needs to be answers about what the Hays Group has said. I would feel more comfortable if Senate Bill 90 specified if they were going to take in consideration the Hays Group or not. I still feel like there are too many loose ends.
All right. Any other comments from the school board? Okay. We'll move on to the next item. This will come before us again in 2 weeks, and we'll move on to the next item. We're back in order now. So we're going to first reading of Board Policy 5144, Student Rights and Responsibilities. Can I have an administrative report, please?
Yes, President Pauser, if Rob Piku, Executive Director for Instruction, could come up.
His doesn't work. Mine doesn't work. Whatever.
Good evening. The first board policy has to do with attendance, and basically it was an effort to clean up the language in this policy so that students weren't marked absent just for being 35 minutes late. The way it was written is a regressive policy. It was actually encouraging behavior that we were hoping to correct. Parents who had their child late 35 minutes would say, hey, if I'm going to bring him in 35 minutes late, I might as well bring him in at noon because he's still going to be marked a half a day. So we just wanted to clean the language up so it would help schools, especially in light of the ASPE rating at the state level, so schools weren't getting penalized for absences when students were actually just tardy.
Member Larson.
It says 3.5 hours. Is that's a half a day or a
day? That would be a half a day.
Half a day, okay.
And they will be marked a full day if they're under 35 minutes late?
Correct. If they're under 35 minutes late, they would be marked a full day.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Member Wilson. Williams.
This is more of a question for President Pauser. Are we only discussing these additions, or can we discuss other additions as well?
We have quite a few board policies here that we are discussing, but we're not opening up the whole...
No, just in this policy, other sections within this policy.
I think the intent was to discuss what the how it's written, what changes were recommended by the policy committee.
Okay.
So I think that's what we're going to discuss. But did you have something else you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I did have one or two suggestions.
Okay, we can have the board policy committee also consider that, and that would be an appropriate time.
Okay.
And then if they wanted to make changes, they could bring that forward. But we'll really muddle it up if we try and, do two or three different things to the same policy. So just the half day versus full day at this point. All right, is there anybody else who wants to comment on this one? Okay, so we'll move down to the first reading for board policy, school-sponsored trips. And if you can fill us in on the recommendations for that also.
Madam Chair, there was one other part of the student rights and responsibility that had to do with presumptive sanctions. I don't think it's written on there.
Okay.
And that one had to do with presumptive sanctions. If you look on page 18.
No, I missed them on the first reading of the other one. Okay, so page 18. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
That change is recommended. Previously, students who had a TAD offense in sixth grade, the presumptive sanction was three TAD offenses, and they would be recommended for expulsion. So technically, a student could be recommended for expulsion in their ninth grade year for offenses that occurred in middle school. So basically, it starts over in ninth grade. So a student gets a clean slate once they go to high school from middle school. So the recommendation is that way we don't have as many expulsion students that are being recommended for TAD offenses.
Just out of curiosity, a TAD offense, what do students need to do once they have those?
Once they have a TAD offense, I would have to ask Executive Director Mike Bervalo to come speak to the TAD offenses. But specifically on this one, it was drug offenses.
Okay.
So basically a student who had a drug offense in middle school twice, they come to ninth grade, they get a fresh start when they come to high school, and then so before they get recommended for expulsion.
Okay. Are there any questions from the board on this portion? Okay. We will have another chance in 2 weeks mm-hmm. to talk about this also. All right. And is there one more on this one also?
No, Madam Chair. The next one had to do with the student-sponsored trips, and I'll have to ask Executive Director Mike Bervalo to come up and speak to that one.
All right. So let's move on then to school-sponsored trips. Item C, Board Policy 6153.
All right. Good evening. The changes on school-sponsored trips are basically come down to taking away the language that would bring it to the school board for out-of-country travel. And that it's just falling into our current operating practice that we've done for the last several years. It has not come to the board. So our current practice is it doesn't do that. And that was at the request of, I believe, from listening to Dr. Promo several years ago, the board had asked that. And so it's just changing the language, updating it to our current practice. The second part is making a change from it coming to central office just to the principals. And that would be for in-state travel. Activities, going to Anchorage. We have schools traveling all over the state all the time. And principals go through the process of approving at the building level. At this point, we're going to request that it just stops at the school level with the principal signing off on it. And that's typically the way it's done. So we're just trying to clean up into what our current practice currently is.
Okay. Does any board member have questions on this one? All right, we're going to move through these fast, it looks like, guys. Okay, so we're moving to first reading BP 6174, English language learner education. So do we have an administrative report on that one?
You know, that's a fairly simple explanation there. It's just very old language that I used to reference bilingual. We no longer use that terminology, and we're just trying to be current with those, really what's reflected in best practices now as English language learner and cleaning up that language.
Okay. Sounds pretty straightforward. Is there any board member who has questions on that one? Member Welton.
I have a policy procedure that we have to take care of because I believe we're going to go past 10 o'clock. So I would like to move that the board meeting go past 10 o'clock.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any objection? All right, we will be going past 10 o'clock, and hopefully not too much past 10 o'clock. So, again, English language learner, we're just changing it to update terminology. The next one is the first reading, BP-6142, AIDS instruction. Is there a update on that one for us?
Yeah, again, in accordance with the policy review that we've been conducting with the committee chair, Welton, we're just cleaning up language. That AIDS language went back into the 90s, and so we're really just trying to update and become current with really what would reflect, again, just best practices and what the rest of the world's doing.
All right, so if I'm looking at the back, it looks like we would just delete this policy altogether.
Correct.
Because they're learning about it in a different board policy.
A different policy.
All right. Okay. All right, we'll move on then. 14055, Birch Tree Charter School Literacy Assessment. So we will need a administrative report on this one.
We have a request from a Birch Tree Charter School, and it's the request is for a waiver for new state regs as they are being required for K-2 literacy pieces. And the administration of Birch Tree and also at the request of their APC has asked for that waiver. The waiver has to come through our school board to the state. And so I do have the principal from Birch Tree Charter School here, Ms. Kathy Busby, who can answer questions.
Is there any school board member that has a question on Birch Tree Charter School's waiver request? Member Larson. Ms. Busby, if you could come up to answer questions for us, please.
I also have Executive Director Monica Goyette, who would be available, who can also speak from the instruction part and also from being a past elementary principal at Shaw Elementary.
Okay, so we have a few people who can answer our questions. Hopefully they won't get that in depth. So go ahead, Member Larson.
Good. Thank you. We supported Birch Tree when it came through as a charter school, and we still support Birch Tree. However, the state has changed the law. This is a K-3 or K-2 has to be tested. So I guess my question is, what is your responsibility to the literacy when the kids are state says they have to be tested in literacy, yet it's not taught till the third grade. So I see a predicament here. So what's your responsibility to that kid becoming able to read there?
So we do teach literacy starting in first grade. Our kindergarten program is very different than the rest of the school district. We're a very social, play-based kindergarten, and it's a half-day program. So in first grade is when we start our formal reading instruction. So our students, in a way, are about a year behind the other students in the district in first grade. But by third grade, our students have caught up to the other students in the district. So if we were to do the literacy screener at K-2, our scores on our literacy screener would be very much off from the rest of the district if we did those tests. So that's because of our philosophy and our Waldorf philosophy, we would just request that we would not have to do that mandate screener.
If the school board agrees with the waiver, but the state rejects the waiver, what's your alternative to that?
We would comply with the waiver. We wouldn't comply with the waiver. We would comply with the state with the mandate.
Which means what?
we would do the literacy screener for grades K-2.
And still have that low in K?
Yes, and I would come back to the school board and explain to you why our scores are, why they are like that.
Yeah, that, I guess that's my big concern because it's a state mandate, I assume. And
right, and we recognize that. And, you know, what we want to go back to is in 2010, our charter was granted. It was a contract between Birch Tree Charter School and the state and the school board. And at that time, we said we will do all state mandated testing beginning in third grade. I realize that the state has now changed, you know, the mandate to include K-2. But our program and our philosophy is so different. We just don't think it would be the right thing to do for our students at our school.
No, the state did approve the charter also.
Yes, they did.
And now they've changed the rules.
Yes, they did.
Interesting. Thank you.
Member Rutherford?
I want to make sure that we're using the correct language. For one thing, I want to make sure we understand this is an assessment, not a test. The test brings up images in people's minds. And this is a 1 to 3 minute assessment, literacy assessment, fluency assessment.
That's correct. In kindergarten, it is four 1 minute probes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in first and second, it is 3 1 minute probes.
Mm-hmm. I also want to clarify that the district has a different requirement than the state is mandating. The district requires once in kindergarten, twice in first, second, and third, three times a year. But the state is only mandating once a year in all of those grades. I read it this weekend. And the state is only requiring it once a year, but we require it once in kindergarten and three times in first, second, and third grade.
In kindergarten, we do...
In spring.
We start in the fall with the name of the letter. Do kids know the name of the
mm-hmm.
letter and the sound of the letter? And then in winter, we add nonsense words and phoneme segmentations. We had previously, prior to this regulation, been doing all of that except for the phoneme segmentation.
Right.
So we do that three times per year.
Yeah.
And actually, the reporting requirement to the state just requires a one-time assessment for the actual report.
Right.
For that information going out to parents.
Right. And the school board, you'd said it needs to come through the board to go to the state, but I don't believe it does need to come through the board to go to the state. If
well, when you read the charter... The charter basically states that the request for the waiver would come through a local school board.
Okay. And we have no authority to waive anything but district requirements.
Correct. At this time, there's no language that would... The initial charter was based on that they would comply with all of our state-required testing SBAs. And, of course, they don't have high school students, so there's no high school qualifying.
And we already have waived some district requirements or altered district requirements.
Correct.
For other tests.
Correct. And Birch Tree has chosen to participate in some district assessment in the MAP assessments.
And then finally, that comment about coming before the board and explaining scores, that wouldn't be true if the benchmarks were different, because in those other tests, I'm sure using different curriculum and materials, your benchmarks are different than ours, and so your scores are probably different, so they may be outliers, and we don't ask for a big explanation for that now. So given that your benchmarks would obviously be different because you have a different methodology, I guess I'm just not buying that little piece that it would come to us because it would be this big, huge outlier. It shouldn't be an outlier because they'd have their own separate benchmarks that would be in line with their methodology. Because the state's not mandating benchmarks. They're mandating the assessment once a year. They're mandating collection of data, but they're not mandating specific benchmarks. We have our own benchmarks. But there you go.
Yeah, Yeah, and the primary purpose for this K2 assessment is really, in effect, to operate as like an early screener and identify students who need that early intervention or that early help, and so that they can get put in a situation where they can start to get happy.
So on that note, he said we have it in there so we can identify children who need early intervention. I know you do literacy at your school. You screen for that, and you do have early intervention for children who might have difficulty reading, or do you wait until the third grade?
No, we will start screening in mid-first grade. And in some cases we do use the Ames Web. Other times we use other screeners with our school, and then based off of that we do use intervention groups too. So,
okay. Member Dearman.
I don't have a question, but may I say something, please? Sure. Thank you. I spent time with Principal Busby this afternoon at Birch Tree Charter. And we spoke at length about this topic. And I think that the fact that this is built into the charter when Birch Tree started, them asking for this waiver from testing in kindergarten, that we should look at that very carefully and honor that. And if, in fact, like Principal Busby stated, the state does not honor our request and does ask that the school comply, she has been, again, very forthright this evening and said that the school will do it. But I think that since it is part of their protocol and the formula that works there, that if it can be maintained the way that it is, until they go after their 10-year charter, that it should be allowed to continue.
Any other school board member? Member Michelson.
Are there other Waldorf programs in the state that are having the same dilemma?
There are. There's a private Waldorf in Anchorage, but there's also a public charter, Winterbury. And they're in the same situation with the screening, and they are complying with the state and doing the screening.
So what is the consequence for low screening scores if the state didn't let you out of the waiver that presumably that we might approve? Where do the scores end up, and what is the, if it's kind of a false result?
It is for ours. So if we were screening our kindergarten students, we would comply, we would screen them, we would send the results into the state, and we still probably would not place them in intervention groups at that time because they have not been taught, they have not been exposed to the instruction of reading. So, again, we have it in place pretty well at our school that mid-first grade is when we start our screening and we start with our intervention groups, and it seems to be working very well for us because we do well on the SBAs and we've been doing well on state assessments.
I just had a couple of questions. First, if you have been testing in the third grade, and what are you, assessing in the third grade, what are those assessments looking like from your school?
Do you mean like reading assessment screeners?
Yes.
They're okay. I mean, I can't really compare it to the other schools at this point, but sure, we have some students who, you know, are scoring lower who are put in intervention groups, and we have other students who are right on benchmark or higher. So I don't see a significant difference between, you know, Birch Tree and the other schools.
Okay, and that's at third grade. And then I talked to parent of some students that go to your school, a first and a third grader. And she did tell me that at the beginning of the year, the philosophy was explained to her. It was also explained to her if she took her child from your charter school to a neighborhood school at second grade, that she could expect that child might score low on a reading assessment. So I know you are informing your parents. Do you think most parents get that, or do you think that maybe parents are surprised, because we do have a population that moves from school to school. And so I'm concerned about a parent who has their child at your school, maybe leaves your school in first or second grade, gets to a neighborhood school, and is upset. Do you think your parents, most of them, get the philosophy?
I do. We're doing our best to educate our parents. We have required mandatory parent meetings for any new parents coming into our school. We constantly are trying to update through parent education, through our Parents Guild, and through our APC board. So are there still some parents that are surprised? Sure, there are. But also, they're able to come talk to me. I just feel that they do understand what Birch Tree is and what the philosophy is and what is happening at our school.
Okay. Are there any other comments from school board? Okay. This comes before us in a couple of weeks. Then we are down to... We're done. We're done. We're future items, future business. February 5th. Regular school board meeting on February 5th that will be here at the central office. Also February 19th. Is there any items, future items that people would like on the agenda for future meetings? Member Williams.
Just another reminder, since it's been a while since my report, our next student advisory board meeting is January 22nd, the next Wednesday, 9 a.m. to noon at Teeneland Middle School.
All right.
Thank you.
Do we have any other future business that is left off of this calendar? Okay. Seeing none. Let's move down to our second persons to be heard on non-agenda items. Member Welton, if you can keep it really short, I don't see any new people here who missed last time.
Okay. There are guidelines for persons to be heard. Be nice.
That was the shortest I've ever heard her take it. Okay. So are there any members of the public who would like to come speak to us tonight? Come on up and state your name. You have 3 minutes.
Red button.
It's on.
Okay. My name is McGarren Ellaby. I want to say thank you for Release Time Seminary. It really helps because I don't have to wake up as early, and that is amazing. So thank you for that. But I was wondering if we would be able to change that to where it would count for an elective credit, because right now we just release from school and go across the street to the school, to the church, and have release time seminary. But it doesn't count for a credit. So I was wondering if we could get that changed to where it would count for an elective credit. That'd be great, but it would make it easier to get, because if you guys add the extra credits to the 2016 people, it'd make it easier to get them instead of losing 4 years of credits in high school by attending Release Time Seminary. Thank you.
All right. We don't usually answer questions, but what I'll do is assign a person from instruction to get in contact with you, talk with you about that. Okay? All right. Are there any other members of the public who would like to speak? All right. We will move on then to correspondence and board committee reports. Have we had any committee meetings? Member Welton, are you going to report on the joint borough?
I can report unless somebody else wants to. I do have my whole agenda sitting here.
Go ahead.
Okay. At our joint committee meeting, we had the bond construction update, which basically we got here tonight. Only we had pictures here tonight. We didn't have those at the meeting. We did talk a little bit about the emergency services use of schools, because that was the policy was to be examined, and I guess it was pretty much that everybody just says, yes, there is a policy on that. We did discuss a little bit of our preliminary budget and talk to the borough leaders concerning what we are asking and what our legislative agenda is. We gave them copies of the blue book and things. And there was a discussion about Fronteras and the search for the money to build their building, and what the process is and how that's working. And then there was discussion about statewide geo bonds for infrastructure. I think that's it. Member Rutherford may have more.
There was discussion about the investigating shared facilities.
Oh, yes. And that's to be on the next agenda. The discussion concerning maintenance and vehicle maintenance and whether we could join together in a joint shop.
All right. Were there any other committee reports or committees who met? All right. Is there any correspondence? Did anybody receive correspondence that they need to share with the rest of the board? Member Welton.
I think everybody received the somebody inquiring concerning the wood boiler. Was a response sent to someone who inquired as they thought we should be still working on the wood boiler up at Sioux Valley. Did anybody respond to that? I just told them that they needed to contact the borough because the borough was the one who was in charge and talked about that. But that came in email and it was sent to everybody. But I wanted to make sure that somebody from the school district responded to them concerning that.
Okay. I'll follow up with that. Okay, I did receive a letter from Chick Loon, and there was a gentleman here earlier today talking about what was contained in the letter from Chick Loon concerning bus routes and maybe changing bus routes to pick up students. We are down to comments from school board and administration. Administration?
Long meeting, but thank you, everybody, for your participation and comments.
All right. Member Williams.
I think it's been a pretty good meeting. One thing I would like to say is that I know students who are interested in and who would be willing to add suggestions to our student handbook, specifically on the usage of electronic cigarettes and how there's no language against that. And so if we're doing additions and editing, students would be interested in having that put in. I would also like to talk about, just quickly, that the eighth instruction policy, though it is, it has been a long time since it has been updated, I just want you guys to keep in mind that policies like that create discussions within classrooms that not just focus on AIDS, but also lead to other STDs and other STIs. And so even though the policy might focus on AIDS, the discussion that policy creates is actually a really great learning experience for students and is relevant to their lives. Other than that, that is all. Thank you.
All right. Member Dearman.
It was a very long meeting. We discussed a lot, have a lot to digest and think about, and it's been a great way to kick off the new year.
Member Rutherford.
No comment, thanks.
Member Larson.
Thank you. I appreciate this very much, the Sioux Borough School District Insight. It's a nice magazine, which... one of the public businesses out here, private businesses out here, found out that I was on the school board and asked all kinds of questions about what the school district offers, and I referred them to the website, of course, and their response was, do you got any kind of poster that they could put up in their business to support the school district, which says what the school district has to offer kids? And I thought that was an interesting idea, and it's just an idea to throw out there, because they want to support the school district but really don't have any tangible thing to do so except for the website. Thank you.
Member Welton.
I want to say that, you know, I appreciate that we had a long meeting, but we did do some discussions. And we do have some hard decisions to come up against. I was at the Justice Coalition this morning along with Mr. Piku and Diane Demoski and Melissa Mudd, who are members of the school district, as well as other agencies in the Valley, to talk about the issues with youth. And I invite anyone to come to these. They're the third Wednesday, which is our board meeting, at 7:30 in the morning. Yes, it's early, at Windbreak. And I invite you to come to hear about what's going on in the other agencies and how they're faring and what funding issues they have and what education they have to offer. I do want to say I've invited Monica Goyette to speak at Noon Rotary next week at the Wasilla Noon Rotary, which is at the Grandview, and she is to speak on the standards and our response to them and educating a small group of people in the Valley through Rotary Club. And I invite people to come to that. I can't afford to sponsor everyone, but you can come and hear or send people who want to have more knowledge about the standards to that venue. I think that's what I have. People have called and talked to me about issues in the schools concerning, you know, their child being lost in the school, not feeling like they are connected. So that's why I'm interested in when we will do the connectedness survey. And I did ask during the break, and I guess that's coming up in February. Thank you.
Member Michelson.
Just a quick note of appreciation for district staff who... since last time we met, I've been around to talk to Student Support Services, Lucy and Dale, Maintenance Operations, Mr. Anderton, Ray DePriest, and Mike Verbalo, and I do appreciate the time that you've spent kind of bringing me up to speed on the functioning of your departments and things like that. And what I most appreciate is being introduced around to people as well. So I'd just like to express my gratitude for the time that you spent with me. Thanks.
Member Scott.
Thank you. You know, every once in a while we see via the internet stories of students, young people who have shown exemplary character. And I would just encourage you to check out either the district Facebook page or the Frontiersman about a story that happened right here in the Valley with a couple of our wrestling teams. And I just wanted to commend the wrestlers, the wrestler Chris Dawn from PHS, and congratulate the wrestler from Colony High School, Trevor, and encourage you to check out that story because it's one that is well worth a read. Thank you.
I do not have any comments for this evening. It has been a long meeting, and I want to thank the other board members for hanging in there and having discussion, even though sometimes it is difficult, things we vote on and decide. We have no executive session tonight, so that's a bonus. We won't be staying for an executive session. So we are at the end of our school board meeting. Can I have someone move for adjournment?
I move that we adjourn.
I'll second that.
All right. If there is no objection, we are adjourned.